Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. Alright, I feel alright tonight. And I'll bring you precious contraband and ancient tales.
Oh. Right, all right, all right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran at 6 has your morning drive. It's Tuesday. That means two for Tuesday. You're here, two for Tuesday. Get your requests in now. One artist, two songs. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 for you, two for Tuesday requests and more. Coming up in just a few minutes, David Hayes is going to join us. He's a singer and a songwriter. It's been a while since he's been on the show. I think it's been a couple of years since we've had David on the show. He's got a new album vinyl release show that he's doing Friday night at Martyrs. We'll talk about that. We'll hear some new songs, and we'll hang out with David. He's in the PPG Paints green room right now, the beautiful PPG Paints green room, hanging out, and we'll get him, bring him into the studio and talk and hear some of his music as well. And speaking of music, after the 2 o'clock news, I am thrilled that we are going to be welcoming John Doe to the show, one of the founding members of the legendary band X, and he's also an actor, he's also an author, he's got a new book about the LA punk scene called More Fun in the New World. And X is playing, the all original members from the band X, they are playing tomorrow night, Wednesday the 26th, at City Winery. And you can check out citywinery.com. The guy's a legend, and I'm so excited that we're going to have him on the show. John Doe from X, author, singer, writer, actor, is going to be joining us. It's going to be so much fun. Some of the other stuff that we're going to be talking about, we've got apparently it was a nightmare to make the vacation movies. Now, these are legendary movies, and it's summertime, and people are going on vacation, so I thought it would be kind of fun to talk about some of the crazy stories behind the making of the vacation movies and reminisce a little bit about those, because it's that time of year, man. People are taking some time off, and they're going away, and they're going on vacation, so we're going to talk about those vacation movies. Also, since we're going to be talking about punk rock with John Doe from X, we are going to bust out the 50 albums that shaped punk and talk about those and get into how influential they were and how they changed music and all that cool stuff. So there's a lot of other stuff we're going to be talking about. We want to have you join us. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text and your 2 for Tuesday request. Do you have me a 2 for Tuesday? 312-981-7200. So that's what's coming up on the show in just a couple of minutes from the PPG Paints Green Room. We're going to be joined by David Hayes live in studio, and lots to talk about with him. We got to catch up. Haven't talked to him in a while. And then the legendary John Doe from the band X will be joining us, and I'm very, very excited about that. So that's the show for this morning on a Tuesday morning. And let me say hello to my producer, Tom Hush. Hi, Tom. Tom's on the phone.
Hey, how's it going, Nick?
All right. Tom's on the phone right now. So we'll get back to him and officially say hello to him in just a couple of minutes. But Tom's here. He's producing. And let's go into the newsroom. And it's Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Hang on one sec. I'm on the phone with Tom.
How you doing, sir?
All right, man. How are you?
Good, good.
Good. I'm excited about some of the topics that we're doing this morning.
So am I.
Because I just heard that you listened to the Ramones.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, we've got one of the pioneers of the L.A. punk scene.
So crazy.
On the show after the 2 o'clock news, John Doe from the band X.
That is so cool, Nick.
Yeah.
Very cool that
I'm
you're speaking with him.
Incredibly excited. Incredibly
and I
excited.
Just found out about this, so I told you a little while ago, and I'm seriously considering getting my tickets for the City Winery. That would be cool
yeah,
to see him.
If you've never seen X, no. they're a great band. They're a great band. And I know you're having a little bit of a trouble adjusting to punk rock.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't like the Sex Pistols very much, and you're not crazy about the Ramones.
Yeah, and, you know, like, when we talk about this on Fridays, you won't hear me criticize the music, because I don't think that I'm in a place to be a critic, but, yeah. I am. I'm having some trouble getting into punk, but I want to because I get how cool it is, and I think I need to learn more about the movement.
Well, we're going to be talking about the 50, you know, most important albums that shaped punk. And this was, you know, we had this planned before we mm-hmm. even knew that you were onto the Ramones. But we're going to be talking about that too after we talk with John.
That is awesome.
So that's all coming up. Here on the show. And again, if you want to join us, it's 312-981-7200. Vic, did you get to see any of the Cub game?
No.
Oh,
didn't.
Man. It was crazy.
Was it?
Yeah. The fifth inning. Well, first of all, Wilson Contreras did a little jawn with the catcher, the Braves catcher, Flowers. Did you see this, Tom?
I did not.
Contreras hit a home run, like in the third inning, to put the Cubs ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did a little jawn. And the bench is cleared. He did a little jawn with the catcher and the umpire. And at one point, you know, Hayward was holding Contreras back. I mean, they were going to get into some fisticuffs. The bench is completely cleared. And Contreras was like, because they weren't getting the umps strike zone was really inconsistent. And that's always aggravating, like really inconsistent. So they were mad about that. And then I guess Flowers made some smart aleck remark to Contreras while he was up. And so, you know, Contreras, you know, he sees the strike zone the entire game because he's a catcher. And so does Flowers. And I think they both kind of like, you know, were, you know, giving each other a little guff. And I think Flowers said something smart to him and Contreras hit a home run. So he hits a dinger. And as he's running down the first base line, he looks into the Mets dugout or the Braves dugout, and gives a little fist pump, and then just is running around the and when he got to home plate to complete the home run, he started jawing with Flowers, who was at home plate, and then they had to be separated, and then the bench is cleared.
Of course.
So that was the first part of the game, and I thought, okay, well, this is going to be interesting because we're very early in the game, and Contreras is the catcher, so he's going to have to see every player, mm-hmm. every Braves player, including Flowers, when he comes up the bat. So I'm thinking, okay, we're going to maybe see some brawling. And by the way, it was Stranger Things night at Wrigley.
Really?
Yeah.
Were they giving out upside down
they
Cubs
were giving,
hats
giving and, out yeah. stuff, and it was like they had like in Gallagher Way out there.
Uh-huh.
They had Christmas lights strung up on
oh, that's pretty cool.
on the bench that spelled out Chicago Cubs. And they did like, it was all Stranger Things, and Cary Elwes sang the seventh inning stretch.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was, I mean, and you know, there were like 38,000 people out there and you know, the Stranger Things, you know, cast, I believe is in town. Cause Ooh. I think they're doing the, our WGN morning news. I
yeah,
think they're doing that.
Sounds about right.
Because the premiere is on the fourth for the third season. So, but anyway, so it was Stranger Things night and it started out like, and that's what they were saying. They were like, but Stranger Things night. So this is an interesting way to start it off with this weird sort of conflict between these two catchers and then a bench clearing nearly brawl. So that's how it started. And then the fifth inning was absolutely insane. The fifth inning was nuts. The Cubs broke it wide open, got five runs, got five runs in the inning. And then, I mean, they were in command after that. So, yeah, it was fun. And
Tribune's got a good article about how it all started, too.
What do they say?
They say, well, this is according to Contreras, so I'm sure the other catcher has his own side of the story, too. But according to the Tribune, Contreras claimed that he was criticizing, or in his words, he was talking with the umpire, and the other catcher kind of chimed in, and he didn't think it was that catcher's play, so he told him, just do your job. So
that seems about right.
That's a bold strategy.
That seems
a bold strategy.
There's an interesting line that the Tribune has in that article, too. He says right after he told that other catcher, just do your job, he knew, I guess it was a 1-2 count, and he knew that the pitcher was going to try to quick pitch him, so he got ready real quick and smacked him.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. I got to say, that's awesome.
He also says that he doesn't have anything against the Braves or Flowers, the other catcher.
Yeah.
In fact, he praised Flowers, but he also said, you know, I have my team's back, too.
Yeah. Boy, that's pretty cool. Yeah, that was fun, man. It was kind of fun. Now knowing that story, it sounds exactly accurate to me. I completely believe Contreras because that's what it looked like that happened.
Yeah.
So, anyway, well, they've got three more games to play, so we'll see what happens.
It's gonna be a fun ride.
Yeah. So, all right. Anyway, they won, which is pretty awesome. So. Okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, David Hayes is going to be joining us. He's in the PPG Paints green room right now. Bringing him into the studio. And we'll talk and hang out and listen to some of his music and all that cool stuff. It's been a while since he's been on the show, so we're happy to have him back. David Hayes is going to be joining us after the news.
Back by all our fears, afraid to take a risk on it, scared of a little.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on the 18th floor above beautiful downtown Chicago. And we're here. It's 2 for Tuesdays to get your requests in now. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. Coming up after 2 o'clock, I'm unbelievably excited about this. The legendary John Doe from the band X is going to be joining us. They've got a gig. X is playing at City Winery tomorrow night, Wednesday night. And he's got a new book out called More Fun in the New World, which talks about the early 80s punk movement in L.A. So, and he's a legend. So we're going to talk to him. I'm very excited about that. The music that you just heard right now is by our friend David Hayes. He's a singer-songwriter. And he's got a vinyl release show coming up at Martyrs on Friday for his album The Attic. And it's been a while since Dave's been in the studio, but we welcome David back to the show. How you doing, man?
Doing well, thank you.
It's good to see you.
Likewise.
Yeah, so it's a year old for us, but these are the new digs. You've not been up into this studio before.
I have not, no. I got lost on the way here.
Oh, you did? Oh,
of course.
Yeah, that's been happening kind of frequently here. I guess this might be a kind of a difficult building to find.
The upper and lower whacker kind of thing.
That does kind of throw you off, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also the face of our building, we're 303 East Whacker.
Right.
But the entrance, the face of our building is on... is on Columbus.
Right.
So that also might be a little confusing.
It was. I had to double check the address.
Yeah, so. Exactly.
Yeah.
Anyway, you're here.
Yep.
And it's been, what, you told me off the air, January of 2018 was the last time you were here.
Yep.
Wow, that's a long time, man.
Yeah.
Year and a half.
Yeah.
And you've been busy?
I've been pretty busy. I just had my recital with my students at the NMA at the Beat Kitchen, and they did a great job. So now it's been a little slow teaching, and... I've been busy playing a little bit more.
Yeah.
And writing and working on things and stuff like that.
Cool. Well, let's give everybody a reminder. You're from Rockford.
I'm from Rockford.
Yeah.
I moved here in 2001. I've been teaching music since 2005, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like 14, 15 years, man.
Yeah. So able to keep my head above water. Able to pay the rent, keep the lights on, so it's good.
That's cool, man. That's cool. And when did you first get into music?
I was a late bloomer, 16-ish.
Yeah.
I didn't buy a guitar until I was 18, though.
Mm-hmm.
So took a long time to get into it, but once I got into it, I was, you know, in for the long haul.
Yeah. And you're from Rockford, which one of the greatest bands of all time hails from Rockford.
Right.
That's, of course, Cheap Trick.
Right.
Yeah. Did you ever run into those guys?
I have not run in. No, I have not.
Yeah. But I know people have seen Rick Nielsen like shopping for groceries and stuff like that, which I just think is pretty awesome.
I see their kids, but other than that, not them personally.
I've had Ian Zander on the show before a few times, and he's a good guy.
Yeah, yeah.
But they still rule, man. I mean,
they're great.
They're unbelievable. They're as good now in concert live as they were in 1977.
Aren't they playing with ZZ Top in September or something like that?
Yeah. And they keep going, man.
Yeah.
They keep going. And I don't know how
Xander sounds.
It's unbelievable,
amazing.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's got one of the best rock and roll voices of all time.
Right.
And, you know, as far as I know, I think he still drinks and I think he still smokes.
I don't know about that, but his voice still is quality and it's up
there. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's Rockford. Okay, why did it take so long? Why was it 16? Were you just not into music at all?
Yeah, I wasn't into it. It took a long time. You know, I quit when I was 5, piano lessons, and then I quit again when I was like 11. I just didn't like the practice, you know, but it took me a while and I started to appreciate it, got really far into the Beatles, and then that was it.
So there's a movie coming out Friday that I'm very excited about.
Yesterday.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
It's just such a great premise. For people who don't know, there's a worldwide blackout, and when the power comes back, only one guy knows who the Beatles are.
Right.
Nobody's ever heard of them, nobody knows the songs, so this guy kind of starts playing the songs and taking credit for writing them, and he becomes like the biggest star on the planet.
Yeah.
It's a great premise.
Who's it? Danny?
Danny Boyle.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, Danny Boyle, Slumdog Millionaire, right. 28 Days Later.
Yeah, Trainspotting.
Yeah, Trainspotting. Yeah, of course, Trainspotting. That should have been the first one out of my mouth.
That's all right. At least you didn't say part two. Which that was pretty good.
I liked Trainspotting too. I thought it was great.
I did too.
So the Beatles was the first. That was the first band that you really got into.
Well, I got into the Doors in the sixth grade. I would sing like People Are Strange and stuff like that. But the Beatles were the ones that really, I started buying all their albums and copying McCartney and stuff like that.
Yeah. And now, was there a lot of music being played in your house? Lots of albums, radio, stuff like that?
A little bit here or there. You know, they had a lot of Disney records, classical records. So my parents weren't huge into the Beatles or 60s stuff, but it came out with me, you know.
Yeah.
Ended up taking that on.
Yeah.
And but they were all, they're musical. My dad plays the bagpipes. My mom played like bassoon and piano.
Mm-hmm. Bagpipes, so, huh?
Bagpipes.
Yeah. And he's appeared on your album, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
The Attic, not the Attic, Epics Acoustic.
Yeah.
He appeared on
He played bagpipes on your show.
Which was crazy because we had a pitch shift the whole track up a half step just so it'd meet the bagpipes and then down pitch the bagpipes after. It was crazy, but my co-producer Ron Weary on that one figured it all out and was able to make it.
Yeah. That's pretty cool, man.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Little trick.
So 18 is when you got your first guitar, right?
18.
Okay. And you know, so you dove in head first. Did you start writing songs right away or?
I wrote a couple crappy blues songs, you know, but it took a while. I wrote a lot like from like 2004 onward. It took a lot of sifting and kind of going through the ideas, and it probably wasn't until I released the first album in 2010 that I started to understand how it works. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't even know what a producer was, you know, and how to put an album together. Now I've got 5 and it's crazy.
Yeah.
But it's great because you'll have 3-hour gigs and it's like, oh, I got a lot of original tunes I could play that whole time.
Yeah.
You know, and fill it up.
Do you write a lot still?
I do here and there. I don't try to push myself too much. I'm currently working on one of my students' EPs. So I've been helping with that and writing and working on a cover. I demo a lot. You know, I do write a lot. It's just fine-tuning those ideas, sifting through the crap, and making it sound good.
Yeah.
You know.
And your students, when did you start teaching?
2005 or 6.
2005 or 6. Five. Around that time.
Yeah.
And who are your students? Are they their age range?
They've ranged from 3 to 60s plus.
Yeah.
You know? It varies, you know. But private students, I go house to house, and I've able to kind of learn from or get clients via word of mouth, so it's been nice to be independent.
Yeah, that's cool, man. You enjoy teaching?
I do. I really do. It's good to see them rock out. I kind of have my own school of rock, but not affiliated. And they, the kids do really well working together, and that's what I'm trying to have them do it, because they can't all do it on their own. I can't do an album on my own. I
mean, right.
I could, but it needs more.
Yeah.
You know,
so that's one of the teaching things that you have that you're doing.
Yeah.
For the kids.
Yeah. So, you know, teach some drums, teach some bass, guitar, piano. And like last year we did Bohemian Rhapsody, which was crazy.
That must have been nuts.
But we pulled it off. And yeah, this year we did some Muse for the final song.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they did great.
That's great, man.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, David, hang on. Okay. We want to talk about the event that's coming up on Friday night at Martyrs. A great room, by the way. It's The Attic, which is your latest. It's the vinyl release party. And that's on Friday night at Martyrs.
Yep.
We're going to talk about that and more. And we're going to hear a couple of songs.
Awesome.
All right. Very cool. All right. David Hayes is with us, singer songwriter. And yeah. And we'll take a quick break and we'll come back with the news after this on 720 WGN.
Me when she's sober, she's married. I know what she's thinking, but will she be cheating tonight?
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday.
Yeah, man.
Get your 2 for Tuesday requests in now at 312-981-7200, one artist, two songs. Coming up after the 2 o'clock news, the legendary John Doe from the band X is going to be joining us. They got a gig. X has got a gig tomorrow night at the City Winery. We're going to talk about that, plus his new book and his film career, obviously. We have to. He's in Roadhouse, so we have to talk about that. Joining me right now, the music we just heard is from David Hayes, a singer-songwriter. David, welcome back.
Thank you.
You a fan of X?
Honestly, I can't say I am, and I'm familiar. I'm not going to lie to you.
Yeah, yeah, no, of course not. I wouldn't expect you to.
I mean, yes, I am a huge fan. Not every album.
Yeah, now you've seen, but I'm assuming you've seen Roadhouse.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. John Doe's in that movie.
What part?
He's one of the bartenders that skims from the till.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah, yeah.
He's been in a bunch of stuff, too. He's in Boogie Nights. He's in. He's just been in a ton of stuff as an actor as well.
Yeah.
So but David Hayes is with us, and the new album is called The Attic. And tell me, what did we just hear there?
That's When She's Drunk. She Loves Me. When She's Sober, She's Married. it's a song I actually wrote from the lyric first.
Mm-hmm.
I got the lyric at a show one time, and then it just screamed kind of like a country kind of song.
Of course.
You know, in a Stones kind of way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, that one started from the lyric first, because when I write songs, they can start from about four different ways, like either from the melody or a chord progression or a riff, the lyric, or like a rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically the only ways you could start and then build on after that.
Yeah.
That was a lyric first, and it just wrote itself in like 10 minutes.
Yeah. That's great, man.
Yeah.
That's great. Is it on The Attic?
It's on The Attic. It's the last song.
Last song on The Attic. Yeah. Okay. And you got a vinyl release show. You were kind enough to bring me a copy of it on vinyl. I appreciate that, man.
No problem.
Are you looking forward to it? Do you like doing the vinyl thing?
This is my first vinyl.
Oh.
So it's very expensive. It's a lot of weight. It's a lot of records sitting on my apartment floor.
Yeah.
So currently, yeah, I do. It's nice to have. It's huge. It's big. I didn't even press CDs of this one yet, so I might. I don't know. It's antiquated.
Well, people can go to Bandcamp or online and get the music, right?
Right, and it's all streaming under someone else's David Hayes page.
We talked about that before, didn't we?
I think so.
Yeah, we did touch on that before. You're at Martyrs Friday night, 9 o'clock. You've played there before, haven't you?
Yes.
Yeah, that's one of the best rooms in the city, I think.
Yeah, we've had our other release shows there too, I think, for the most part.
Who's in the band?
My bass player is Graham Burris. He's driving up from Nashville. He lives there with his family. And then my drummer is Christian Chamberlain, who lives in the burbs, so he's driving on down. This album was recorded at the old Ivy Lab studios off of Elston and Fullerton, and then is also recorded in Nashville, so I kind of split that. And, of course, I demoed at my place to cut down costs.
And what, do you like Nashville? It's great, right?
Yeah, I had a great time. I've been there about 6 times in the past 3 years. You know, it's very hilly. I think we also talked about this before. I'm a big fib, you know, flatlander.
It
you can't walk anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, if you're downtown, I guess you can, but with those hills, you just got to deal with it.
Yeah. A lot of music in that town, though, man.
It's very
very
competitive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, everywhere, if you walked out, you mentioned downtown.
Yeah.
Every bar, there's a band playing. Every when you in every venue, like on the doors are open, the bands are playing.
Yeah, and they cross the street diagonal too.
Yeah,
kind of cool. Makes sense.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, but it's I've been there a couple times. I really like it.
Yeah,
I think Nashville's cool. It's a great place, I guess, to record too.
Yeah, yeah. The Attic Studio is actually what the album is named after. If you look at the back of the album, you have the Burrito House. The picture of the Burrito House was where the Attic used to reside. Then it moved up to Andersonville near me. But the picture on the back was taken the night the Cubs won the World Series.
Oh, okay.
So it's got some special meaning. That's where the recording studio used to be. And, yeah, so it's kind of like an Abbey Road tribute.
Sure, there you go. So, yeah, that's cool, man. That's cool. You mentioned the Cubs. I know you're a big Cub fan.
Huge.
Yeah. All your life?
Unfortunately,
yeah.
Until lately, yes, yeah, it's been great, you know. But it was tough there for a while,
for many years.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I think about it. I'm 38. I had it kind of easy compared to other people, you know.
Yeah.
And my students had it easier than I did, you know. So
yeah, I mean, young people now,
right?
You know,
the Cubs are winners.
Cubs are winners now. Yeah, we've talked about this before. I grew up on Addison, 6 blocks away from Wrigley.
Yeah.
So it was in my blood immediately. And my father is the biggest Cubs fan on the planet.
Yeah.
He'll sit in front of the TV in late September if they're 20 games under 500 and watch every pitch and scream at the TV.
Right. Yeah. That's dedication. Sometimes I'll cut out then, you know, and I'll be more productive, but I'll still pay attention.
Yeah. I you know, it's weird because, like, it's not weird. It was wonderful to be on the phone with my father right after they won the World Series.
Oh, I bet.
It was a really it was a magical moment. You know what I mean? Because I've grown, you know, my dad's been a Cub fan, diehard Cub fan his entire life.
Yeah.
We got him a brick out in front of Wrigley.
Awesome.
That whole thing. And, you know, I was just, like, really thrilled for the team, but I was really thrilled for my dad.
Yeah.
You know, and my dad's, he's going to be 78 in September. And, and he got to see them win a World Series.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and it was the only time in his lifetime. And I remember how heartbroken he was telling me about, because I was only 4 when the Mets won 40 out of 50 games in 1969.
Yeah.
But I remember my dad being really, you know, upset about it. 84.
Yeah.
84 was a big one.
Yeah.
Steve Garvey. Jerk.
89 was where I started to become more.
Yeah. Boys of Zimmer.
Yeah. I remember Mitch Williams giving me my first autograph.
Is that right?
With my grandma and I. So
like,
that mullet was great.
Yeah. You know? Well, you're going to be busy the next couple of days. Tonight, tonight you're going to see the Stones.
I'm going to see the Stones, yeah.
Have you seen them before?
I've seen them 3 other times.
Okay.
Yeah.
I understand that Sunday night they were unbelievable.
Yeah, I heard they were.
I saw the set list and it was ridiculous.
It seemed like winner.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And then you're going to Cubs games the following 2 nights.
Following 2 nights, we're supposed to have a Cubs dude thread get together on Wednesday night. It didn't work out, so I'm doubling down
Wednesday and Thursday.
Which I do a lot in the summer because what else am I going to do?
Well, it's the Cubs, man.
And it's the Cubs, and tickets are cheaper on StubHub, you know, and can sit in a different
seat. It's still amazing to me how much it costs to go to a Cub game now, considering I grew up
right there
going to the game.
Yeah.
The games and day of just walking in.
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy. Yeah. And the whole area, I don't even recognize it.
What do they call it? Ricketsville?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just so, I mean,
it's
completely different than it was when I was growing up.
It is.
Right. Or even as much as like 10 years ago, it's completely different.
4 years
ago. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, man. So, all right. Well, David, tell me about what song are we going to hear now? Because we're going to hear a full song we want to hear.
I think it's Homefront. I could be wrong.
Homefront?
I think so.
Okay, what's this song? He's got it. That's what
all right,
it is.
Cool.
What's this one about?
This one is, It's about war, I guess. Okay. Trying to reacclimate from it, and just there's a war across the seas, and then there's a war here in America. So
okay, and it's called Homefront.
Homefront.
Okay, this is David Hayes. It's from the album The Attic, which the vinyl release party and show is Friday night at Martyrs. And let's give this a listen. Yeah. Job, man.
Thank you.
Very, very cool. Very, very cool. And that's on The Attic.
Yep.
And the vinyl release party is and show is this Friday, June 28th at Martyrs, 3855 North Lincoln Avenue. It's 9 o'clock. Mm-hmm. You got a couple of more gigs. You're playing back in Rockford in July.
Yeah, July 12th, I believe. I'm playing the Norwegian, which just opened up on the west side, which is nice. And then I'm playing Beloit, Wisconsin the following day at a place called Trucked. I think it's like a farmer's market going on, so I'll be there for a couple hours at noon.
Oh, very cool. So those are some upcoming gigs.
Yeah.
And we have the information on our Facebook page, so people can check it out.
Awesome.
So there you go. All right, we're going to take a break, David. We'll come back. We'll talk more, and then we'll hear one more song. And we're going to hear the full version of...
When she's drunk.
When she's drunk. When yeah. she's drunk. Okay. Yeah. All right. Very cool. We'll awesome. We'll hear that coming up right after the break here on 720 WGN.
Cool.
Did you hear somebody say it's the end of the world today? Now who's got the time for that? Is there anyone you like to blame for your world today? Where do you plan to stop?
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, and we're here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 o'clock, and also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. The music you just heard is David Hayes, who is here live in studio. He's got a vinyl release show and party for his new album, The Attic, which is going to be this Friday night at Martyrs at 9 o'clock. David, welcome back, man.
Thank you.
So the next song that we're going to hear, we'll hear it in a couple of minutes. The next song we're going to hear the full thing, Tom. We're going to hear the when she's drunk.
Yeah.
So we'll hear that in a couple of minutes. But I want to talk a little bit more. You talk about like recording a lot. Do you have a preference? Do you like playing out or do you like recording more?
I think I like recording.
Do you?
Just because... I mean, the adrenaline you get from playing out is amazing, and I can't sleep sometimes for hours after that.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have it being on air and stuff like that.
When I get home at 5 o'clock in the morning, at 6 o'clock tomorrow, I can't sleep.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which can be fun or can not be fun. But with the recording, it's just like you're going to try to leave something here.
Yeah.
And the stuff that you create is kind of like, didn't think you could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't know. I think I like recording.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would like to be a songwriter for someone else.
That would be nice.
Yeah. Not, I don't need the spotlight.
Yeah.
But, just to have someone else kind of take it.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Before we hear the song, and you've been on the show a few times now, and it's always a blast to have you on, man.
Thank you.
The two questions that I've asked every musician that I come in here, let's remind everybody.
Yeah.
The questions that I always ask are, what was the first album you bought and what was the first concert you saw?
Right.
And so let's remind everybody, what was your first album?
First CD, Houses of the Holy.
Ah.
Yep.
All right.
I bought it used. It still probably works, but I haven't used it in a while.
I love the fact that the song Houses of the Holy is not on Houses of the Holy. It's on Physical Graffiti.
Right.
But I always found that to be pretty funny. Yeah. I guess that was, a lot of the stuff that ended up on Graffiti, with Physical Graffiti, was stuff that didn't end up on Houses of the Holy and other albums.
Right.
Like there were like kind of scraps and stuff.
Yeah.
And then what was your first concert?
I think it's the Beach Boys.
I think that's what you said.
It's the Beach Boys or Dan Fogelberg.
Either one of those guys. Yeah.
Which I think I'm going to see Ringo and the Beach Boys later this summer at Ravinia. So.
Yeah, very, very cool.
Yeah.
All right, man. You're a big Zeppelin fan, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You were looking at one of my posts on Facebook where I said one of the worst concerts I've ever seen in my life was
Led Zeppelin.
Zeppelin in 1977. And one of the best concerts I ever saw in my life was Zeppelin 1975.
Okay.
The difference was...
Yeah.
Yeah, the difference was a lot of liquor.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they said food poisoning, but...
Yeah, that's what it was. That's why Paige was on a folding chair for most of the show.
Oh, yeah.
God. You can't deny the stuff that they recorded. I mean,
the power,
unbelievable.
Right? Yeah, I when I first started writing, I used to rip them off a lot.
They ripped off a lot of people.
So it's just going full circle, you know.
Yeah. I've always find it incredibly amusing that the credits on the Lemon song read Page and Plant. Like, come on,
right?
Man.
Or yeah, what's the other one? Baby, I'm gonna leave.
Yeah,
you with Joan Baez or something.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Since those old blues guys did get some money though.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, real good.
That's good. Real but good. The Stairway to Heaven lawsuit didn't.
No, that didn't. No, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Okay, cool. All right, David. Well, again, this is When She's Drunk.
When She's Drunk, She Loves Me.
I love the title already. Okay, so here we go. This is David Hayes from the album The Attic, and you can see this performed live on Friday night at Martyrs. Here we go.
When she's sober, she's married.
I saw her at the show. She looked like she was ready to go. She put her arm around me and I helped her on down the stairs. She ran her fingers through my hair. When she's drunk, she loves me. When she's sober, she's mad.
That's great, man.
Thank you.
I love it. Fantastic. And you know, what's interesting about your music is that you kind of, stylistically, you're kind of all over the map.
Yeah.
Is that conscious? Is that a conscious choice?
The first albums, I think, were a little more over, and yes, that was. This one is kind of a little more reeled in, but with that one, no, that's like kind of country on a
rock
album.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah.
Yes, it is, and I mean, I just like it all.
Yeah.
I play it all.
Yeah,
so,
very, very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Is it by referral now that people become your students?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I was gonna plug it if you wanted to get some students.
You can feel free. They can reach me at davidhayes688@gmail.com if anybody wants.
Okay.
But it's a pretty full load.
688?
688.
So is 687 the guy that's got your website?
It might be. It's that guy.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. David, pleasure, man. Always
Thank
a pleasure. And the Attic Vinyl Release Show is this Friday night, June 28th. Martyrs on Lincoln Avenue. It starts at 9 o'clock. You can check them out in Rockford at the Norwegian and Trucked in Beloit, Wisconsin, on Saturday afternoon, the 13th. All right. Always a pleasure, David. Thanks for coming down.
Thank you very much.
Okay. The news is up in 8 seconds. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio Tuesday morning. So two for Tuesday. Get your requests in now. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. And very, very thrilled to welcome this next guest to the show. He's a legend. He's a true legend. One of the founding members and vocalist and bass player of the legendary band X, John Doe, who is also an author and an actor and all kinds of other stuff. They're playing, X are playing tomorrow night, Wednesday, June 26th at City Winery, and tickets are on sale at citywinery.com. And his new book is called More Fun in the New World. And I am thrilled to welcome John Doe to the show. John, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, Nick, how's it going?
Good, man. Good, good, good. Honored. So honored to have you on the show, man. Really.
Well, I hope I live up to it. That's a lot of legendary and a lot of honored and thrilled and stuff like that. It's a lot of pressure. A lot of pressure, man.
I'm glad to have you on. And are you originally from Decatur, Illinois, here?
That's where I was born.
Yeah.
I think I lived there 6 months and then moved to Tennessee.
No, and you moved to Tennessee. Okay. All right. Yeah. Do they ever describe you as Decatur's own, John Doe?
I don't know. I have to go there and see if there's a plaque somewhere. We'll see. I think if anybody can claim me, it would be Baltimore, because that's where I really grew up from.
Yeah.
You know, like third grade up until I went through school and, you know, a little bit of college and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about how the band got together.
Oh God, ancient history. 1977, Billy and I answered each other's ads in a free paper, classified paper called The Recycler. It wasn't free. You had to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I met Exene at a writing workshop around the same time, and then it took about 8 months for us to find DJ Bonebreak to play drums.
Yeah,
and then the rest is history.
Rest is history, and it's amazing you guys are still playing together. There aren't a lot of bands from that era that are still together, and you guys you're going to be here in Chicago tomorrow night.
Yeah, same members, all original. I mean, I think Los Lobos could claim somewhat the same thing. There's a few, but it's far between. We're kind of the last punk rock band standing.
Yeah, well, that's God bless you, man.
Mm-hmm.
So it says here, I got a bio in front of me that says John Doe was born in 1977 when he arrived in Los Angeles. Can you kind of expound on that?
Sure. I mean, I was of a certain age, very influenced by Andy Warhol, and I grew up, like I said, in Baltimore. Also was friends with John Waters and the whole idea of taking a pseudonym to be, whoever you not were born, but what you were meant to do. So
yeah.
I also loved the movie that Gary Cooper was in called Meet John Doe.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, plus I have a kind of unpronounceable Czech name, and I thought, what the hell, I'll be John Doe.
Yeah. And
easy to spell.
When you got out there, what was it? Had you ever been to Los Angeles before that in 1977?
Actually, a friend of mine and I went out there in March of 76, and then I moved there permanently in the beginning of November of 76. Mm-hmm. So 77 is when, you know, things really started to happen.
Yeah. I want to get into your book as well. More Fun in the New World. But I want to talk a little bit about that punk scene in the 80s. I mean, what was it like? What was the energy like at that time?
Well, the punk scene started in LA in 76, beginning of 77. So, this book is the second 5 years, you know. We had a book out in 2016, and that was Under the Big Black Sun.
Right.
And that was the first 5 years. That was like 77 to 82. This 80, the next one is 82 to 87. So by that time, you know, people were starting to get signed to record companies, and we got signed from Slash to Elektra, and the Go-Go's were, you know, top 10, and there were other people like Lone Justice, which are represented in the book.
Mm-hmm.
They're, you know, getting produced by Jimmy Iovine and stuff like that fairly soon after they started. So things got, you know, big fast.
Yeah.
You know, after a slow start, you know, when I say fast, it's like we've been playing since 77. It wasn't until 82 that we got signed to Elektra. But in the meantime, you know, we had two records out on Slash Records, which is a really small indie, independent distribution as well, which was totally frustrating.
Mm.
But in LA, you know, in the Midwest, we were drawing maybe 300 to 500 people, but in LA, we could draw 5,000 or 6,000. So it was pretty, you know, pretty schizophrenic. Like, yeah. who am I? But that's, you know, it still sort of happens.
And with this book, the latest, I mean, because the other one was called Under the Big Black Sun, and this is the follow-up, More Fun in the New World. This is all-encompassing, man. You have so many contributions from so many important artists from that era and mm-hmm. beyond. Was it easy to get these people involved and to write for the books and stuff?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, I think, you know, people like to tell their story. If you're, you know, if you're at a dinner party and you say, so what do you do, or what turns you on? You know, people like to talk about themselves a little bit. And it became clear that somebody's going to tell the story, so why shouldn't it be us? Or why shouldn't it be you? You know, we had to do a little convincing of a few people. But, you know, Luis Perez from Los Lobos, and then we, you know, and Charlotte Caffey and Jane Wheedland of the Go-Go's, and then there's other ones that people might not know, like Chip Kinman from Rank and File, or Terry Graham, who played in the Gun Club, and stuff like that. So we get a chance to shine a light on some people, that singers and, you know, musicians that people might not know.
Was this?
And, and then it goes into the whole legacy part of the book, which is another kind of angle that we took.
And what was it? Was the scene at that time? You know, or even before when you first started? You know, like the years before you got signed at Elektra. What was the scene like then? Was it supportive? Were people sleeping on other people's couches? Was there competitive stuff happening? What was it like?
Oh, it was a really tight community.
Yeah,
and people had to help each other because there was no outside help. You know, it was a very DIY scene, and I'm sure you experienced that in Chicago with certain groups. You know, at certain times, and I'm sure that Wilco and the people surrounding them, the bands that came up with the Bloodshot label, they all had to work together because they didn't have a lot of outside support. But
yeah,
you know, as time goes on, the scene gets bigger, and so things can branch out, and that's kind of what this book deals with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the first 3 years, I mean, everybody had to help each other because nobody had any dough, and that was part of the deal. Is you wanted to live a bohemian lifestyle, and that didn't mean you made a lot of money, so screw it, you
yeah.
know, let's just do this thing because everybody says we can't.
Right. Yeah, it's funny. The only thing that I've come close to personally is I did many years of theater here in Chicago and storefront theater, directing and acting and writing and stuff, and it was a tight-knit mm-hmm. community. That was one of those deals where you're not making any money, you know, 60 people are coming to see a show that you put up. And then,
right.
you know, but you get help from everybody, volunteers, people, friends. It's a very tight-knit community in terms of that artistic world.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, it's kind of a creative explosion when that happens. And you can't really force it. It's just sort of, who knows?
Yeah.
If you could predict that, then you'd be a multi-mogul. A mogul's mogul.
That's it, yeah. The book is called More Fun in the New World, and it's got tons of great stories contributed by people who were there at that time in the scene, great artists, and so on and so forth. John, hang on, okay?
All right.
All right, John Doe is with us. He is a legend. X is playing tomorrow night, Wednesday, June 26th, at City Winery. They've been around since 1977, and it's amazing that all the original members are back, are together, and they're performing tomorrow night. And if you've never seen the band, you should. When we come back, we'll talk more about the book. We'll talk about John's solo records as well. And then we got to get into the acting because he's been in some television shows and some movies that are near and dear to my heart. So we'll get into that right after we take a break here. More with John Doe after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your Tuesday morning drive. 2 for Tuesday, get your requests in, 312-981-7200. We are talking with John Doe, who is one of the founders, singer, bass player for the legendary band X. He's got a book out. The latest one is called More Fun in the New World, The Unmaking and Legacy of L.A. Punk. And it is a tremendous book. And we want to welcome John back to the show. John, welcome back, man.
You're welcome.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about some of the pictures that are in this book. I want to mention that really quickly. There are two sections of pictures that are just fantastic. Were those from people's personal collection and stuff?
Mostly from the photographer's collections. There's a couple on the inside of Pleasant Gaiman's chapter and a few others. But mostly from, you know, there were some legit photographers that were real, you know, Ouija-like, you know, shoot on the fly and document the scene. Ed Culver and Laura Levine and Ann Suma and, you know, spread out all over.
It's some of the great pictures. You know, they really do capture that time. And they're really beautiful pictures. They're all great. There's a great picture here. The first picture that's in the picture section is of Angela Moore and Jane Wiedlin at an IRS uh-huh. record party. Two of my favorite people. I made the mistake of dropping Angela Moore when he stage dove. I dropped him through my friend and I dropped him through a table. I felt terrible about it, you know, but it was at the Vic Theater here in Chicago, and he went right through the table. We thought we had him, uh-huh. and then boom, he went right through the table, and then got right back up and jumped back up on stage.
Of course he did.
Yeah.
You know, and the funny thing is that we just played in Kansas City, and I who did I call up? Oh, I was talking to somebody doing a book thing, and they said, oh, and I mentioned that because Fishbone is also in the book.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a conversation with Angelo and Norwood.
Yeah.
And I said, and by the way, people, if Fishbone is playing, go see them because they are still amazing. And Angelo is like 110%. He doesn't know any, you know, any different speed.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
When he's off stage, then it's like 98%. You know?
Right.
But anyway, and the guy says, oh, they're opening for George Clinton tonight in Kansas City. And it's like, God, freaking,
what's
the luck?
Oh.
So, yeah, we had to play, and they played, but we texted back and forth. And,
yeah. Fishbone's one of the best live bands I've ever seen. I mean, they're just the energy is absolutely insane. I love those guys. Always have. Incredible.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful stuff.
Great stuff. And there's stories about that and many other artists in the book, More Fun in the New World, which is available right now. And again, you can see X tomorrow. You excited about it? Have you ever played City Winery before, Joe? John?
I think we played. I think we did the album series like 4 or 5 years ago. We did a few cities where we played all four records, the first four records, in four different nights.
Oh, cool.
I think we did that at City Winery.
Yeah, it's a great space.
And awesome. And actually, I played there. That was in Boston. Never mind.
Okay.
there's another city. A new City Winery in Boston.
Okay, got it.
But yeah,
All right. Tell me about the solo records. You enjoy doing that?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's more of a labor of love, and I mean, not that playing with X isn't, but and actually we're working on some new music with X, so hopefully that'll be out next year.
Oh, that's very, very cool.
Who would have thunk it?
I wanted to, there's this legendary movie that you guys appear in, and it's, of course, Decline of the Western Civilization. Penelope Spheres mm-hmm. put that together. Can you tell me about being a part of that?
Well, it was sort of a transition. It came out in, I think, 82 or maybe 80, middle of 81.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a transition between, like, what was the original, very eclectic and tight-knit community, and then the more violent and kind of negative hardcore scene. Which was just a, you know, an extension of what we had already started.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the time, though, we had hoped that the original scene would be captured on film. But, in retrospect,
it's a really good time capsule.
Yeah.
At the time, we were wishing that more bands that were, you know, represented what we originally started would have been represented. But yeah, it's a crazy movie. I mean, there's some really great performances, and they had a great crew and great filming and good editing. So you really get a good idea of what happened at the time.
Yeah, it's a classic movie, and I love the follow up, The Metal Years. That I find extraordinarily entertaining.
Yeah, I couldn't bring myself to watch that.
No, it's I understand, but it's a goof. I mean, it really captures that weird time period there in the late 80s with the hair metal and everything. Pretty perfect.
I bet.
Yeah.
I bet.
Transitioning into acting, how did that happen for you, John?
Oh, there was an agency that booked X, and they had a theatrical division. And so, I would give Allison Anders, who also contributed to this book, the main credit, because she did a movie called Border Radio, and she used a bunch of musicians as actors, and she asked if I'd be in it, and it was rewarding. So I, did a few small movies, and then I got cast in this movie with Harry Dean Stanton, and I was doing some scenes with him, and I realized I was getting so left in the dust.
Yeah.
I took some classes, and I did some improv and stuff like that, and got a little bit more got up to speed a little bit.
Well, you have appeared in some of my favorite movies and some legendary stuff. Man, Roadhouse. John, you're in Roadhouse.
Yes, I am. The most expensive B movie ever made.
Yeah. You know why I love that movie? For many, many, many reasons. I love it because it was co-written by a woman and directed by a man named Rowdy, and that's the movie. And what was it like working on?
It shows that you are very in touch with your 13-year-old self.
That's exactly
and,
right.
I guess that's a good and a bad thing. I think it's good to be.
Yeah.
It was just insane. It was like, what's going to blow up today?
Yeah.
What's going to get wrecked today? How many cars are going to get wrecked? How many things are going to explode? And how many fight scenes are there going to be? But it was great. I mean, to just be part of it and watch all that stuff go on. I mean, it was insane. I'm working a little bit on writing a memoir, and Roadhouse is definitely a full chapter.
Yeah, I would imagine. There's some stories. Yeah. Let me give you a quick aside, John. This is one of my favorite connections to Roadhouse. Kelly Lynch, who's obviously in the film, husband is really, really good friends with Bill Murray. He's a screen.
Oh, yes, I know about this.
You know the story? He calls him up
every time. Yeah. Every time his wife is having sex with Patrick Swayze.
It's the best, one of my favorite stories of all time.
Like I said, 13-year-old boy. Right?
Yeah. You are also, I want to mention one more movie here that's from my favorite filmmaker. My favorite filmmaker is Paul Thomas Anderson. And I love your scene in Boogie Nights, man. What was it like to work on that?
I was just there for a day, so I was in and out, and no pun intended. Paul Thomas Anderson had a real vision, and he had a color palette for what happened when, I was in the brown period, and before that was in the blue and yellow period. And, it's an incredible script and really well put together. And a lot of people will say, oh, you're the a-hole that is in the movie. And it's like, no, I am not. I'm actually the good guy.
Yeah.
Who's trying to protect this kid from, a pretty sketchy group of people.
Yeah.
But the thing that Paul did is that he made you identify so much with his lead characters.
Yeah. Yeah.
That I made, I made Julianne Moore cry. So I was a jerk.
Right. Right.
And I was being closed down. I was being very specific, and they were all, I think the scene before is Heather Graham and Julianne Moore snorting coke and her asking her if she could call her mommy.
Yep.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. Now you were only there on the one day. You only were there on the set one day. You only shot that one day. Man, when you saw the movie, were you like, oh my God? I mean, it had to be like,
oh no, no. I had read the script, and I actually thought the script was even better than the movie. But I mean, just because maybe my imagination went wild or something. But the script wasn't quite as graphic. It didn't have all. I mean, it mentioned sex scenes and stuff like that, but you didn't really, imagine it the way it is. So it was bigger on the screen, but actually the story was kind of cooler on the page. But I knew what was happening, and it was, Mark Wahlberg was just kick ass in that.
Yeah, he was great.
He was something else.
A great performance.
He was really good.
Great performance.
Yeah.
Listen, man, it's been a real honor talking to you, man. And I admire everything you do. I admire everything you do, from the writing to the acting to the music. And it's just been a real pleasure to have you on. You guys are playing tomorrow night, X, at the City Winery, Wednesday, June 26th. Go to citywinery.com for more information. And More Fun in the New World is available right now in bookstores everywhere and online. John, real pleasure, man. Have a great time in Chicago when you get here.
Thank you, Nick. We'll see you out and about.
Okay, take care, buddy.
Okay, bye.
Bye. John Doe, everybody. That was pretty cool. All right. Every once in a while, we get a guest on that's an absolute legend, and that was just one of them right there. The book is called More Fun in the New World. It's available now, and they're playing, X is playing at City Winery tomorrow night. Okay, we'll take a quick break, and we'll come back with the news after this.
I saw a werewolf with a Chinese menu in his hand, walking through the streets of Soho in the rain. A place called Lee Ho Fooks. Gonna get a big dish of beef chow mein.
Oh, I love Warren Zevon. It's impossible to describe how much I love Warren Zevon. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. It is 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday. And that's one artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. And who requested the Warren Zevon?
That was our good pal Ike.
Ike with a little Warren Zevon. All right. Well, welcome back, everybody. It is Nick DiGilio, and we're here until 5 o'clock on a Tuesday. We are heading towards July, and a lot of people take vacations in June and July. And so maybe some people are out there taking vacations. One of the most memorable movies about taking a vacation is, of course, National Lampoon's Vacation, which is basically a classic. Chevy Chase, Beverly D'Angelo, Anthony Michael Hall, Jane Krakowski is in the film briefly. She's a really good French kisser. Her dad told her so. That's the Randy Quaid, Cousin Eddie. John Candy, directed by the great Harold Ramis. A very funny movie about anybody who's ever been on a road trip, written by John Hughes. It was based on a piece that he wrote in National Lampoon that was based on the actual road trips that he took with his family. And it became a monster hit, and it spawned sequels. But evidently, it was no vacation for the cast and crew to make these vacation movies. I got an article here from Ranker.com, and if you want to read it, the full article is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/NickDShow. You should like us right now. But here are some behind-the-scenes stories, and this is going to be a shocker, Tom, but some of these stories involve Chevy Chase being a jerk. I don't know how...
What?
Isn't that shocking?
Since when is Chevy Chase known as being a bad guy on set?
I don't know. It's a shocker. I'm so unbelievably surprised that some of these stories might involve bad behavior on the part of Chevy Chase. But here's a little background. National Lampoon's Vacation was the 11th highest grossing movie of 1983, earning $61 million at the North American box office. Aside from being a major success for former Saturday Night Live star Chevy Chase, it spawned four sequels. National Lampoon's European Vacation, which followed in 1985. National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, which was in 1989. Vegas Vacation, without the National Lampoon affiliation. That came out in 1997. And the Back to the Basics reboot of Vacation in 2015. In each movie, family man Clark Griswold or his grown-up son Rusty in the reboot tries to give his clan a perfect, memorable vacation, only to have a series of comic complications foil his efforts. Didn't they make one with just Randy Quaid?
Did they?
Like, maybe it was straight to video or something, but it was like, I think it was like Cousin Eddie's Vacation or Cousin Eddie. It was
it's not part of the mainline series, I know, because it's Vacation, Christmas Vacation.
It's European Vacation, Christmas Vacation, and Vegas Vacation.
Yeah, that's and the last. The reboot. And then the reboot, yeah.
Yeah. But I think there's a Cousin Eddie one. Might want to do a little research. I think there was a spin-off movie with Randy Quaid just as Cousin Eddie. And I think it was like Cousin Eddie's Vacation or something like that.
No, it's... oh, my God. One, it is made for television.
Yeah.
Came out in 2003. Titled National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation 2, Cousin Eddie's Island Adventure.
Oh, there you go. So that's not featured here in this article.
Oh, no. Well, because it was a joy to make for everyone involved.
Yeah, I'm sure everybody was very happy about that. The humor comes from his increasing desperation when things inevitably go wrong. Though the movies are lighthearted comedies, their productions are often reflected the series' core concept. Tons of problems sprang up and needed fixing. Cast and crew members found themselves feeling like a real-life Clark Griswolds as they struggled to give audiences something special and unforgettable in the midst of absolute chaos. Jeez. a peek behind the scenes of the Vacation movies reveals the many challenges that went into making them. There are tales that involve bad behavior, logistical nightmares, intense fears, and, of course, crazy Chevy Chase stories. So gas up the family truckster and get ready for a wild ride. So the Vacation movies, as they stand, without Cousin Eddie's Island of Adventure or whatever the hell it was, the first Vacation is terrific. It's very, very funny, and I enjoy it very much. National Lampoon's European Vacation is terrible. Essentially unwatchable, just like not even remotely funny. National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation is good. It's very funny. And it's become sort of a holiday classic, and Vegas Vacation is actually, I think, worse than European Vacation. And the reboot was with Ed Helms and Christina Applegate. It had moments, but I don't know if it was a necessary movie to make. So, but here are some of the behind-the-scenes stories about working on all of the Vacation movies. And if you have a favorite Vacation movie moment and you want to jump in here, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. One of my favorite moments in the original Vacation, there are a lot of great moments in that movie, but one of my favorite moments, besides Chevy Chase's meltdown in the car, don't touch that whole thing, is just, everything Eugene Levy does at the beginning of the movie as the car salesman, everything he does. And he's got the first massively big laugh in that movie. Because when he sees Chevy Chase and Anthony Michael Hall pull up, he has this look. He does this double take, does this great double take, and he's got this look on his face that just every time I see it, it's one of my favorite moments in the entire movie, is just Eugene Levy's double take and his facial expression when he sees them pull onto the lot. Because clearly, you know, he's going to take them for all he can get, and he's going to give them the wrong car. I also love that moment where, when Chevy Chase is like, I want my old car back, because it's not the car that they ordered. The family truckster is not indeed what they wanted. But meanwhile, they're crushing the car down in the compactor, and then he goes, I want my car back now. And then they bring it out, and it's completely smashed down, and he still tries to open the door. Like, it's just so stupid. Also, when he's trying to find where you put the gas, That whole scene, I mean, just, God, there's so many funny scenes in that movie. And here's Trucker Rich on WGN. Hey, Rich.
Hey, Nick. You remember the tagline for that car? You know, like Ford had, you know, you're going to love a Mustang or whatever, but the tagline for that car, the family truckster, was you hate it now, wait till you drive it.
Yeah. That, it's a very hilarious looking car. There's no question about it.
Yeah. Have you ever seen the Barrett Jackson Auto Auctions?
I have. Yeah.
Scottsdale, where they sell the real expensive fancy cars, like when they sold the Batmobile for over $6 million.
Yeah.
They sold a family truckster for like $120,000 out there this year.
$120,000?
Yeah.
Wow. For the actual family truckster.
It was one of them.
Did it say honky lips on the side?
Yep. It was just exactly everybody's signature on it, you know.
Yeah. Oh, that's pretty cool.
Except for Chevy Chase.
Well, of course. You know? Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Everybody else said you're gonna hate this car as much as we did. Yeah. As we did.
Yeah. You know, that's fantastic. Yeah. $120,000. Wow. All right. Thanks, Rich.
Yeah. All right, man. Have a good evening. Yeah.
If you hate it now, wait till you drive. Story of my life.
It's also the reveal that they spray painted honky lips on the side of the. On the side of the car. Oh, it's a very funny movie, man. Very, very funny movie.
I actually did not like any of the vacation movies when I first saw them.
Any? You didn't even like the first one?
Nope. I didn't like it. Because people always try to be like, oh, yeah, we got to watch Christmas Vacation. It's Christmas time. And I would watch it. And it wasn't even everybody else. I thought everyone else was pretty good. I just really had a problem with Chevy Chase.
Yeah.
I just didn't think he was funny. But then I watched it again at a Christmas party after Die Hard, and it suddenly clicked.
It's a funny movie.
I suddenly found it really funny, and I don't know why.
It takes about 15 solid minutes before it becomes, because the whole sled thing at the beginning and the tree thing at the beginning is really not very funny and forced. But once it settles in and all the family shows up, the relatives all show up, it is hilarious. It's absolutely hilarious.
What do you make of the reboot with Ed Helms?
Yeah, it was all right. I mean, Vegas Vacation and European Vacation are both unspeakable. They're both horrendous. But yeah, I mean, the first one, the Christmas Vacation, I like very much, and the reboot, I didn't think it was necessary. That's the problem. I just didn't think it was necessary. I mean, you know, I like everybody who was in it, and I think there were some singular funny scenes in it. I just did, when it was over, I was like, why?
I only saw it for Applegate.
Yeah, well, I'll see anything with her.
I'm not an Ed Helms person. I really? Just, I don't see the appeal.
I thought he was great on The Office. I hated the Hangover movies.
See, that's what I couldn't stand his character on The Office. And I know maybe that's why he's so good, is because he's supposed to be like the most punchable person of all time.
Yeah.
But I couldn't get past it. I was just like, God, I hate Andy so much.
Well, I thought he was great on. I hate the Hangover movies. I can't stand them.
Yeah.
They're not funny. They're not. All three of them suck. Man, what was the name of the movie where he was. He was at like a corporate function, like a business convention.
Oh, is it? It's Cedar Rapids.
Oh, that's a good movie. Cedar Rapids. That's a good movie.
And was he's in The Goods, right?
Is that the Jeremy Piven?
Yeah.
I don't remember.
I think he is. And I actually enjoy that movie, even though it's objectively like just really terrible, horrible racist jokes and all. It's juvenile.
And it's a complete ripoff of Used Cars.
Exactly. I don't know why. I think it's hysterical, especially Catherine Hahn in it is just doing things that I couldn't believe.
Yeah. Not a fan. Not a fan.
I totally get it.
I just kept, when I was watching it, I was like, you know what? I could go home right now and watch the funniest movie ever made, which is called Used Cars. You know. All right, how about this? Here's your first behind-the-scenes story. Well, let's take a break. Why don't we take a break, and we'll come back, and we'll start the actual behind-the-scenes stories of the making of all of the vacation movies. There's some real insane stories here. And if you want to jump in, do you have a favorite vacation movie, a vacation character, any of that stuff? What's your biggest laugh in those films? 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. More behind-the-scenes of some of the nightmare stories about the making of the vacation movies after this. like going deep on that.
Yeah. A Tales from the Crypt episode featuring Brad Pitt.
Yeah. Okay. Two for Tuesday, man. 312-981-7200. Two for Tuesday, man. So that's continuing. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right. You know who I forgot to mention is also hilarious in Vacation? Imogene Coca.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. So funny. And she's a comic legend, too. All right, we're talking about the behind-the-scenes stories. Everybody loves, you know, at least a couple of the Vacation movies, especially the first one. But they were not the easiest movies to make. They were kind of insane behind-the-scenes stories. It's summertime. It's vacation time. I thought we'd talk about the Vacation movies. And if you want to jump in here, if you have comments about the Vacation movies, what are your favorite ones, your favorite scenes, your favorite characters? And then I've got some behind-the-scenes stories for you. And it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. Here's your first one. Amy Heckerling loathed working with Chevy Chase. This is the first story featuring somebody not liking Chevy Chase. I believe this is going to be a recurring theme as we read these stories. Amy Heckerling, who was the director of Fast Times at Ridgemont High and later Clueless, signed on to direct National Lampoon's European Vacation after original director Harold Ramis opted out of the sequel. See, because Harold Ramis read the script, and he went, no. her experience making the movie was not entirely happy, as she and the film star did not see eye-to-eye during the production. She told FlavorWire that working with Chevy Chase, quote, was not a marriage made in heaven, unquote. In fact, Heckerling apparently disliked Chase so much that she was ready to bolt from the set at any moment. I couldn't go on the set unless I knew I had... in my hand, a physical ticket to New York so that I could just go at any time. I had to hold it in my hand so I knew that I had a way out. My God.
That bad, huh?
Whew. Wow. How about this? The first movie's, I knew this one. The first movie's ending was changed because test audiences hated it. When it came time to test National Lampoon's Vacation to preview audiences went wild. The only thing that they didn't like was the ending, which they overwhelmingly hated. The original conclusion featured the Griswolds storming Roy Wally's home after discovering Wally World is closed and then forcing him to entertain them by singing and dancing. Because of the poor reaction, a new ending was shot four months after the formal production wrapped. The update, which finds Clark compelling a security guard to let his family ride rides at gunpoint, went over much better with audiences. Interestingly, Vacation's original ending was repurposed for Christmas Vacation, where Cousin Eddie kidnaps Clark's boss and drags him to the Griswold home. That's exactly right.
Wow.
The great Brian Doyle Murray. You know what's really funny is if you watch Vacation... And they did have to reshoot it's a true story. They had to reshoot that ending because everybody hated the original ending. So it was 4 months later, and Anthony Michael Hall shot up. He went through puberty. So if you watch the movie, at one point, you know, towards the end of the movie, Anthony Michael Hall is about a foot and a half taller than he is in the rest of the movie.
Damn. didn't they have some like blockers or something to put on this kid?
I don't know.
It's
got to
be in the contract. He was puberty.
But it's really funny. I've seen the movie a million times. But Anthony Michael Hall is like clearly a foot and a half taller in that last sequence at Wally World. 724 area code says John Candy tried to start his own vacation franchise with Summer Rental in 1985. I'm trying to remember. Could you look up Summer Rental? Because I think Carl Reiner directed it. Carl Reiner directed Summer Rental.
85, music by Alan Silvestri.
Yeah. There's some funny stuff in that movie. It's not great, but there's some funny stuff in that movie. This is Maggie from Norwich. Says, hey, Nick, the scene where he keeps driving in circles. Oh, look, kids, it's Big Ben. That's in European Vacation. So... I don't remember it. I remember Eric Idle was in European Vacation.
Well, you gotta.
That's the only thing I remember, and he wasn't funny in it. I don't know. And if you can make a movie and make a member of Python not funny, you've really succeeded at something. Making the first vacation required a grueling real-life road trip. In National Lampoon's Vacation, the Griswold family travels from suburban Chicago to the fictional Wally World theme park in California. To make the movie, the cast and crew went on a grueling real-life road trip not dissimilar from the one in the fictional that the fictional family takes. The bonus features on the special edition Blu-ray reveal that to get the necessary footage, the production traveled hundreds of miles, stopping to film in six different states. Aside from Illinois and California locations, they shot at the Grand Canyon in Arizona, where the Griswolds paused briefly to sightsee, and St. Louis, Missouri, where the family truckster passes the famous Gateway Arch. Colorado, Monument Valley, also provided locations for the exhausting summer-long trek to combat the heat in desert locations. Gigantic air conditioners helped keep the car cool for the actors. That sounds like a nightmare.
I would definitely think twice before setting out on a road trip to California from here.
Well,
I think it would be a great drive. It'd be fun, but
my parents, and when I was a kid, when we went on vacations, we always drove. Like, I didn't get on a plane until I was like 17 or 18 was the first time I was ever
really?
On a plane. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I was like 18 years old when I first took a plane. We drove everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We did road trips. You know, we drove to, we didn't drive to California, but we drove pretty far west. We drove to Florida twice, which is a trip that Steve and Johnny make like bi-weekly.
God.
I know.
And they're just going to the panhandle.
They're going to the panhandle there.
What's that, 20 hours?
At least, yeah.
Because I, for my freshman spring break, I drove from Chicago to Daytona Beach.
Oh.
It took 22 hours, and in the last 2 hour stretch, there was a car caught fire, like way up. We were literally 2 hours away, and we were stuck in traffic for another 3 hours.
Oh, God.
Just basically parked, watching movies on a laptop because we had nothing to do.
That's a nightmare. That's a nightmare. That's another thing we could tie into this conversation. If you ever had real nightmare road trips, 312-981-7200. If you have any nightmare road trip stories, and I'm sure everybody has. I think everybody's been on a really bad road trip at some point where it's either something bad happens or you get lost or you have car trouble. Yeah. So 312-981-7200 if you want to add that to the mix. We're talking about the vacation movies, the behind-the-scenes stories of how difficult they were to make, and your favorite moments and characters from the movies. And let's do some real-life nightmare vacation road stories as well. We'll jump back into it. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. And the news is up right after this.
I don't want you to be no slave. I don't want you to work all day. I don't want, cause I'm sad and blue. I just wanna make love to you, baby.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago here on a Tuesday. Two for Tuesday, man. Yeah, two for Tuesday. One artist, two songs. 312-981-7200. Who requested that?
That's coming to us from Camille, Little Rolling Stones.
Yes. Well, they're playing tonight at where the hell are they playing?
Soldier Field.
Yeah, they're playing at Soldier Field.
That big old stadium.
Yeah, their place down there. Yeah. All right. Geez, it should be nice getting down here tonight for work.
Yep.
Oh, God. I was just thinking about that now.
Might hang glide or something, try to take some alternative means.
Yeah. But you know what? Coming downtown won't be bad. Because, you know, we take the Kennedy down to Ohio to Michigan. And then in Michigan South.
Yeah, man, speak for yourself. Your boy here's got to take Lakeshore Drive.
You going to take Lakeshore Drive?
Well, I might take the Inner. I usually take the bus. So normally I'd hop on the 146 a little bit quicker, but 151 takes the Inner.
Yeah.
So hopefully it won't be too bad, but you never know.
Well, I mean, it should be okay. I mean, you're up, you're north, right? You're in Uptown.
Yeah.
You should be okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so fingers crossed. You never know. You could get some people coming from up north, floating, you know.
Because when the concert lets out, you know, that'll be around the time when I'm coming down here to go to work. Because I usually get here a little after 11. So it should be okay coming in on the Kennedy. I mean, it might be a little tight coming in on the Kennedy. But once we get on Michigan Avenue going south, it might be a little shaky. But I think going north from on Michigan Avenue is going to be a nightmare. And I think
it's gonna be...
going north on Lakeshore Drive is going to be a nightmare.
Yeah. So maybe I'll be able to avoid it.
It's a Cub game. There's a Cub game tomorrow night, too.
Exactly. I come in a little bit earlier than you do. I come in an hour or two before you do. So I usually get done in by the Cub game. That's what really does it for me.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, the Stones are going to cause problems now. So, 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to join us. We are here live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. Two for Tuesday continues if you want to get in. And we're talking about the vacation movies and what a nightmare some of the vacation movies were behind the scenes. And then also, if you want to jump in here with you have favorite moments in the vacation movies or characters or scenes, 312-981-7200. And also in real life, if you've had kind of a nightmare road trip vacation, we would love to hear from you. 312-981-7200. Okay. Here are more behind-the-scenes stories here. The crew stopped a real dog tied to a moving car incident. For those of you who might remember in the first vacation movie, they forgot that they tied Aunt Edna's dog to the back of the car and then ended up killing the dog, dragging him down the highway as they were stopped by highway patrolman James Keach. But apparently there was a real dog tied to a moving car incident. While the rest of the family goes on to so many continued adventures, Dinky the dog doesn't make it through the first vacation. Clark inadvertently leaves Aunt Edna's pooch tied to the car, leading to little more than the slap on the wrist from a cop over animal cruelty. The grim turn of events was inspired by urban legends of real-life canine road trip mishaps. But according to director Harold Ramis, life very nearly imitated art. In a 1983 Late Night with David Letterman interview, Ramis revealed that while production was based in Durango, Colorado hotel, sure enough, this is Ramis talking, sure enough, someone saw a station wagon pulling out of the Holiday Inn with a dog tied to the bumper. It was definitely a confirmed sighting, and don't worry because the filmmaker assured everyone that they saved that one. All right, here's Doc on WGN. Hey, Doc.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
Hey, I'm not a big Chevy Chase fan, but my wife loves Vegas Vacation, so I've seen it a few times.
Uh-huh.
But I love when Chevy Chase is sneaking off to play blackjack, and Wallace Shawn is just terrorizing him.
Yeah, I don't...
You know, at one point, Chevy Chase says, I'm like, what can I get for $5? And Wallace Shawn says, buy a bullet and rent a gun.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't remember any of a Vegas Vacation. I only saw it the one time.
Well, you know, Ethan Embry, you know, plays as Nick Papa Giorgio as his fake ID. And I remember him from Empire Records, but I just want to mention another movie he was in, Cheap Thrills with David Koechner.
Great movie. Great movie.
Oh, God. One of my faves.
No, it's a great movie. And the great Sarah Paxton is in that, too. That is Tom, have you seen Cheap Thrills?
Yeah.
It's a great movie.
I could tell you a pretty bad road trip story.
All right.
When I was in graduate school, my roommate gets one of these auto drive away cars. You know, you're driving somebody else's car to another city for them.
Right.
He gets a Volvo wagon, takes it from Phoenix to, he lived in Pennsylvania. Perfect experience. We try and do the same thing, and except the other direction. And graduate school's in Phoenix. My best friend from college lived in L.A., so it's his girlfriend and him and me, and we had like a 74 Maverick. We leave St. Louis. We stop where we used to go to college, a couple hours from St. Louis, to try and find some smokable materials. Can't find anything. We had a little bit. We're passing through on the interstate through Columbia, Missouri, and a van is passing us, and my best friend says, Amy, quit waving that stuff around. And she just waves it in front of the window like, woo-hoo. This guy's an off-campus policeman at University of Missouri with his family. He calls the cops, and we are pulled over by, like, Columbia cops, Boone County, Missouri Highway Patrol. They tossed the car. We just had a little bit that I rubbed out on the floor. They let us go. We go to Kansas City, get my stuff, take off, and this car is just not running right. We get to New Mexico, and literally it's choking out, and his girlfriend and I have to get out of the car and walk up the hills on the freeway because it wouldn't pull all three of us. And we stopped, and it needed a new fuel line filter, and you're authorized to make a certain amount of repairs. So we get to a station where somebody's able to repair it, and we could proceed. But it was like, of course, the bad thing is we're driving, you know, 1,100 miles to Phoenix and them on to L.A. with no smokable material.
Right.
But it was just a proverbial nightmare.
Yeah.
It's like, could it get worse?
Yeah, that sounds terrible. All right, Doc, thanks, man.
All right.
Take care, buddy. Yep, see ya. smokable material.
Didn't have a lid between them.
Nope. The old drive-away car. That's what C. Thomas Howell's doing in The Hitcher.
Man.
That's what he's... Drive-away car.
So, let me get this straight. People would you get paid to do it? You get paid to drive, you know, take someone's car to a new location for them.
Yeah. That's what C. Thomas Howell's doing in The Hitcher.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a while since I watched The Hitcher.
Yeah.
So, no, that makes sense, I guess.
How about more behind the scenes? This is a behind the scenes story about the about making the reboot with Ed Helms. Christina Applegate feared drowning during a whitewater rafting scene. For the 2015 reboot, Vacation, the screenwriters came up with a comedy set piece that placed Rusty Griswold and his family on a whitewater rafting trip. As with most things in the series, the activity doesn't go according to plan. While the family is scared on screen, one of the lead actors was absolutely terrified for real. Christina Applegate told Fox News that shooting the sequence was harrowing for her because the actors were required to get in the water and drowning was a real possibility. They had guys in wetsuits and rescue gear all down the thing because if you did fall out of the boat, you were gone and you could drown. So there was an element of fear for me there. And when we were in the boat and the water would come and push it down, you really felt, I mean, a couple of times I thought I was going to fall out. So that's Christina Applegate talking about her experience shooting the whitewater rafting scene in the reboot of Vacation. How about this? 314 area code says, my honeymoon was a trip to the covered bridges of Madison County. Nice place to change your shirt. Should I know what that would?
I'm not sure what that means.
Okay. 847 says, can't see the line. Can you, Russ? Nope. That scene always gets me. All right. Let's take another quick break, and we've got more behind-the-scenes stories about the massive issues that were behind the scenes making the movies, the Vacation movies. If you want to be Vacation movie stuff that you think is funny, 312-981-7200. If you have like a road trip, nightmare road trip story that you would like to share as well, again, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here. It's 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday. Get your requests in now. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We are currently talking about some of the behind-the-scenes stories about the making of the Vacation movies that were nightmare stories. So it was not easy to make these movies, and we've got some more of these stories to share. And if you want to jump in with any of your Vacation movie memories or anything like that, or if you have a road trip that went awry, 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. How about this? Imogene Coca was terrified of being in a car. Comedy legend Imogene Coca played the cranky Aunt Edna in the original Vacation. While she was game for the movie's R-rated humor, she wasn't happy about having to film scenes inside of a moving vehicle. Coco was terrified of car travel. That's because she and her husband got into a car accident in 1973 as they drove home from a dinner theater performance in Florida. Her husband only sustained a minor injury to his leg, but Coco wasn't as lucky, fracturing an ankle, breaking her cheekbone, and suffering a cut up her leg. A piece of the rearview mirror also went into her eye. Good Lord!
That's bad.
Oh, my God! According to the bonus features on the 30th Anniversary Edition Blu-ray, the subsequent phobia caused a lot of anxiety during scenes where she had to sit in the back seat of the car. I can understand that. Wow.
Poor Imogene.
Wow. See, now I'm going to watch this movie again, and I'm going to watch for Imogene Coca, her reaction while she, because she does a lot of scenes, and most of her scenes are in a car in that movie.
Her face is just belied by abject terror.
My God, that's horrifying.
I would have tried to find a runaround for her, like a workaround, because that's a lot to put her through.
It is a lot to put her through, and she's Imogene Coca. She was a legend. She was a comedy legend.
Yeesh.
Man, that's really... I had no idea. Jeez. Now, it's going to be weird to watch it the next time. I'm going to feel bad for Aunt Edna while I'm watching it when she's in the back seat. Wow. By the way, she's hilarious in that movie. Hilarious. Chevy Chase, here's the next story. Chevy Chase made Vegas Vacation to avoid a lawsuit.
Sounds about right.
It does. After European Vacation, Chevy Chase worked with Eric Idle on a script for Australian Vacation, which would have taken the Griswolds down under for an adventure. Okay. That idea didn't end up going anywhere. Instead, Chase ended up in Vegas Vacation, a movie that was mainly made to avoid getting sued. According to the official biography, I'm Chevy Chase and You're Not, by Rena Fruchter, the actor had a three-picture deal with Warner Brothers, for which he was paid $23 million. Wow. He contractually owed them one more movie, but didn't like any of the scripts that the studios wanted him to do. When they proposed Vegas Vacation, he agreed to play Clark Griswold one more time to fulfill his obligation. The comedian's participation, quote-unquote, he says, came out of an agreement avoiding a possible lawsuit. I like the idea of Eric Idle writing a vacation movie. That would have been pretty cool. He gets a three-picture deal at that time for $23 million. Wow. Wow. So he didn't want to get sued, so he made Vegas Vacation. It's like, whatever.
I feel like there's a great number of movies that were made to avoid lawsuits.
There's no question about it. There are people who sign contracts who are like, okay, I got to do this stupid movie.
Yeah, three-picture deal, five-picture deal, whatever.
Yep. $23 million for Chevy Chase, though, for a three-picture deal. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
That's 80s money.
It's one of those things where you're like, oh, no, you have to make a movie now?
Yeah.
Oh, no, they paid you $23 million?
Yeah.
Man.
All right. Let's see. Here's Glenn on WGN. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, good morning, Nick. How you doing?
All right. What's up?
Not too much. Well, it wasn't much of a horror trip. But we were moving back from California to back to Wisconsin, and it was two families. We had two rental trucks. I was towing a camper on our station wagon, and my friend was towing a camper, and yeah, it was about a five-day trip with about 15 people.
Yeah.
And like I was telling Tom, the first day on the road, we realized that giving kids soda was not a good idea.
No.
Especially you're going to be in a car for 6 to 7 hours.
No.
Well, we made it back alive, but
yeah.
I'd never do it again.
Never do it again. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
God, no.
No. Okay. All right, Glenn,
all right,
thanks.
Have a nice morning.
Take care.
Yep, bye.
Do not give the kids pop if you're going on a road trip from California to Wisconsin.
Water only.
Yeah. All right. Here's the next one. And again, I believe this is again Chevy Chase oriented. Shocker that there are multiple behind the scenes nightmare stories about the vacation movies that involve behavior of Chevy Chase. Chris Columbus walked away from Christmas Vacation. Following the success of his comedy Adventures in Babysitting, Chris Columbus came in to direct the third installment of the franchise National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation by writer-producer John Hughes. Unfortunately, Columbus left the project after having an ill-fated dinner with star Chevy Chase. Columbus told Chicago Magazine, quote, Chevy treated me like dirt. I stuck it out and even went as far as to shoot the second unit. Then I had another meeting with Chevy, and it was even worse. Columbus asked to be let go from the project. Hughes felt so bad about the whole situation that he offered Columbus the chance to direct another holiday-themed comedy that he had written, and that movie was Home Alone. So he ended up getting Home Alone out of the deal.
I'd say that's an overall win.
It is. I mean, I hate the movie Home Alone, but it is. I mean, in terms of money, in terms of like a successful project.
Yeah, that probably sets him up to do Harry Potter.
Yeah. Well, no, it's a lot of years between Home Alone and Harry Potter.
I know, but it's like you put that on the resume.
It set him up to do 9 months with Hugh. Just one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, no, that's
how the hell did Julianne Moore end up in that movie? I swear to you, when I saw that movie, I couldn't believe how awful it was.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Columbus directed a lot of bad movies.
I know.
He directed Mrs. Doubtfire, which is an unwatchable movie.
But successful. You got to give him. Yeah, he's a workhorse. Yeah. Kind of, he'll direct anything.
Yeah.
And he thought it was a good idea to take that second Harry Potter movie. It's like 3 hours long. That's a children's movie.
Yeah.
Okay, family. The whole family going. But 3 hours long.
Yeah. Well, anyway. But he's a big successful guy. You know, right out of the gate, the guy writes Gremlins. That's his first script.
True.
Right out of the gate. Well, of course, you have Joe Dante directing.
Yeah, which can't really go wrong.
No. All right. Let's take a quick break. We got more behind-the-scenes vacation stories here. We are going to jump into some of the albums that shaped punk rock, because we had a punk rock legend on with us earlier, John Doe. We'll discuss some of those albums coming up as well. News is up after this. You can't have a two for Tuesday without Rush. Yeah, Rush!
Vic got very excited.
But Vic, you got excited about Rush?
All right, let me defend myself. I was starting to tap my toes and move my head, and I thought, they're playing Poison? I thought it was Poison. It's really bad, guys. I'm telling you.
That's Rush. That's Rush.
Rush rules, man.
The big difference between Rush and Poison. who requested the Rush?
Who else but Canadian Bill?
Now, of course.
Good man, Canadian Bill.
Canadian Bill requesting some Rush on 2 for Tuesday. You do for Tuesday, Rush! 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. So we've been talking about some behind-the-scenes stuff on the making of these vacation movies. Some of these stories are unbelievable. The car crash story with Imogene Coca, I'm still stunned by that.
That's kind of depressing. That's like really sad.
It's so sad. How about this one? Beverly D'Angelo feuded with the director of Christmas Vacation. Christmas Vacation marked the directorial debut of Jeremiah Chechik. It was a tough position to step into since Chevy Chase was a creative player with notoriously strong opinions, and it wasn't Chase the director clashed with, though. It was Beverly D'Angelo. During a Q&A session following a special screening of the movie in the 2000s, Chechik recalled that his frequent arguments with D'Angelo got very heated at times. Though he didn't go into specific nature of these fights, D'Angelo told Chase's biographer, I felt like he kept trying to talk to me like I was an idiot about filmmaking, and it bothered me. D'Angelo added that she disliked Chechik disliked that Chechik kept telling everyone that he was going to elevate the franchise, implying that he didn't think the previous Vacation movies were very good. Well, to be fair, European Vacation was a piece of crap, and that was the one that came right before Christmas Vacation. So, what did this... I'm trying to remember what else this Jeremiah Chechik directed.
Let's find out.
I know he's directed. I know he directed a couple of other good movies. If I'm not mistaken, I don't know if he's, you know, and then I think he started working in television pretty frequently.
Let's see. He did Benny and June.
Oh God.
Yeah. No. I hate that movie.
Me too.
The remake of Diabolique.
Oh, that's right. He did direct that, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the Avengers, but not those Avengers.
Oh, God, he directed
the British
that?
Avengers, yeah.
Wait, maybe I don't think he did direct anything good then. What could I have been thinking of?
Maybe The Bronx is Burning?
No.
That's actually, have you seen that, The Bronx is Burning?
Yes.
I like the book a lot better, but it was an interesting version of the book.
I guess I didn't remember this guy's credits at all.
Yeah, I just love that he was nominated for Worst Director at the 98 Golden Raspberry Awards for The Avengers, the British Avengers, but lost to Gus Van Sant for the Psycho remake.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. Boy, that Avengers movie, that movie was terrible. Terrible.
Yeah.
Casting made sense. Ralph Fiennes and Uma Thurman, that makes sense.
Sure.
But, oh, man, was that bad. How about this? An untrained squirrel was let loose on the set of Christmas Vacation. Boy, this Chechik guy sounds like a director of good control.
I'm going to elevate the franchise.
Yeah.
Quickly, bring me my squirrel.
Bring me my untrained squirrel. In one of the most memorable scenes in Christmas Vacation, let me just mention this. The first time I saw Christmas Vacation, I was sitting next to the late, great Roy Leonard. And it was in the screening room, and that squirrel scene, seriously, I don't know if I ever saw or heard Roy Leonard laugh harder in my lifetime of knowing him. He was on the floor laughing, the entire squirrel scene. And it's a very funny scene. It's one of the funniest scenes in the movie, in fact. But, man, I remember going, Roy, man, wow.
He lost his mind.
He lost it. He loved that scene.
Ah, Roy.
In one of the most memorable scenes in Christmas Vacation, Clark startles a squirrel nesting inside the family's massive Christmas tree. The scared creature jumps out, runs around the house, causing a ton of chaos and destruction. If the scene seemed oddly real, it's because an actual untrained squirrel was let loose on the set. I wish Roy were here so he could hear this background story. Director Jeremiah Chechik told Rolling Stone that an animal trainer spent months training a squirrel as well as the dog meant to chase it. On the day of filming, they discovered the trained squirrel had died. Without time to teach another, they got a wild squirrel and unleashed it while the cameras rolled. Though things did not go according to plan at all, the scene became more authentic and probably funnier as a result. That's fantastic.
Oh, my God.
That is a fantastic story.
Just found in a pool of its own.
Oh, that's so funny.
What happened? Oh, he did an eight ball, and now he's dead. The squirrel.
Let's just get another squirrel, throw it on the set.
You got to imagine there was some PA's job to actually go get the squirrel.
Yeah.
Like, I need you to find a squirrel.
See, that's another
here,
another one. I want to go back and watch that scene now, because like if there's a real untrained squirrel running around on the set, the actors are probably reacting pretty realistically. How about this? The actors all got sick on the roller coaster in the first Vacation. At the end of National Lampoon's Vacation, the Griswolds ride Wally World's biggest roller coaster with a security guard played by John Candy. There was only one way to shoot the scene, by having the actors ride the coaster for real. This led to some very serious upset stomachs. On the DVD commentary, director Harold Ramis reveals the cast had to ride the coaster 7 times to get the footage that they needed. Everyone ended up nauseous by the end of the 7 trips. Actor Dana Barron was hit especially hard. She needed to take motion sickness medication and lie down on a beach between takes. I remember actually hearing that John Candy got sick. I didn't know that the rest of the cast got sick. He gets sick in the movie, too.
Yeah.
He's like, and they're covering his mouth.
That's weird. I have never experienced motion sickness.
Really?
Never once.
When I was a kid, I couldn't read in the car.
That, I feel like that's the most common one.
And I can. I mean, I don't really, because you know. I mean, I can now, though. I have, because like yeah. if I'm in a car or something, and I check my phone or I read something, mm-hmm. it's fine. But I used to get like really nauseous.
Was it? Did you have glasses as a kid?
No. No.
I wonder.
Never had glasses except for the cheaters that I
yeah,
wear.
Yeah, yeah.
My huh. reading glasses. That's it. My cheap reading glasses. So. Yep. All right. Here we go. There was too much snow for the sledding scene in Christmas Vacation. Most of National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation was shot on the Warner Brothers lot in Burbank, California. There isn't much snow in Southern California, though, so the cast and crew traveled to Breckenridge, Colorado for the outdoor sequence in which Clark rides an out-of-control sled, as well as the opening scene where the family cuts down their tree. Director Jeremiah Chechik told Rolling Stone he and the crew were shocked to discover that no snow when they got there. The production had some of the white stuff trucked in, and then the real deal abruptly arrived. There was a lot of logistical issues, and just as these trucks were rolling up, it finally started to snow and continued and continued and continued. It snowed something like 10 feet in 3 days. It became near impossible to actually shoot because there was so much snow. Chevy Chase told Rolling Stone, "There was enough snow on that hill to put me in a effing sled that sped down going 100 miles an hour, and it scared the living daylights out of me." All right, how about this one? Anthony Michael Hall got busted trying to peep on his movie mom.
That's gross.
Beverly D'Angelo, man. You're not going to peep at Beverly D'Angelo?
Stay in character.
Anthony Michael Hall, who originated the role of faithful son Rusty Griswold, got into trouble on the set for inappropriate behavior, and a Maxim magazine oral history producer, Maddie Simmons, revealed he caught Hall trying to peep on his on-screen mother, Beverly D'Angelo, during her nude scene. Simmons recounted, "I grabbed him by the shoulder and said, 'Get the hell out of here.' He was angry. The young star would try to violate the privacy of a fellow cast member." Years later, Hall didn't deny the allegation, saying, "I was totally trying to sneak a peek. Was I conflicted that she was playing my mom? You know what? At times I was."
Be a professional, man.
No, that is unprofessional. It is. But it is Beverly D'Angelo. So, and that was one of the issues that I had. I remember one of the issues that I had with the original Vacation was that I find Beverly D'Angelo much more attractive than Christie Brinkley. I just was like, every time Clark would be, you know, he would ignore his wife, Beverly D'Angelo, and, you know, be obsessed with Christie Brinkley. I was like, that's no.
I don't buy it.
Beverly D'Angelo, I find her much more attractive. And I mean, you know, Christie Brinkley's beautiful, you know, perfect California sunny model thing. But Beverly D'Angelo, man.
Smoke show.
A whole lot, another whole, you know, level. Closer to the heart. Yes, closer to the heart. Yeah! Whoa! Yeah, man, Rush. Yeah. Two for Tuesday. Canadian Bill picking some Rush. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here. It's Nick DiGilio. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Right here on WGN. Okay. Getting back to some of these behind-the-scenes stories of making the Vacation movies, and some of these stories were pretty crazy, and it, for some people, it wasn't a vacation to make those Vacation movies. Let's see. Shooting in Europe took a toll on the cast. For most people, a months-long trip across Europe would seem like a dream come true. For the cast of European Vacation, it was more of a nightmare. For starters, Chevy Chase wasn't happy with his director. He told biographer Rena Fruker that he didn't enjoy making the movie. "I had problems with the director, Amy Heckerling, a very lovely person, but I didn't think her direction smacked of energy and humor," Chase said. Beverly D'Angelo, meanwhile, told Furker that Chase's wife was pregnant back home, which made being so far away very difficult for him. She also said that the actors disliked the cold weather and the script wasn't funny. That's the behind-the-scenes story of, and then the movie turned out terrible. So that should tell you something right there. 262 area code says Beverly D'Angelo is way more beautiful than Christie Brinkley, especially when she was in the movie Every Which Way But Loose with Clint Eastwood. Yeah. Ethan Embry called Vegas Vacation, quote, a horrible film, which was brought up a little bit earlier, Ethan Embry being in the movie. Though it subsequently gained a cult reputation thanks to heavy rotation on cable TV, Vegas Vacation stands as the lowest grossing and commercial and generally worst regarded installment in the theatrical franchise. The sequel was followed by an 18-year hiatus for the Griswolds. In 2015, Ethan Embry, the fourth actor to play Rusty Griswold, declared, "It's a horrible film, let's face it." He played Rusty? Why do I not remember? I don't remember anything about Vegas Vacation. I just remember I thought it sucked. It's really the only thing I remember. Embry was more upbeat in his appraisal of Chase, however, saying, "My favorite moment was Chevy teaching me physical comedy in his dressing room. Sitting there listening to him talk about certain gags and how to pull them off, what tricks are, it was pretty cool. He was kind to me. I have fond memories of that guy." Wow! Somebody speaking nicely about Chevy Chase. Yeah, you don't hear that very often. Especially in any book ever written about Saturday Night Live. Ethan Embry.
He just he finally settled a beef with Gwar.
What?
Apparently there was I think it was a kind of a made up beef. But
how could you beef with Gwar?
I don't know.
Why would you beef with Gwar?
I don't know. Apparently his was it in Empire Records? He was Mark, right? Ethan Embry.
I don't remember the character's name. I know he's in it.
Yeah, he's in Empire Records, and his character gets devoured by Gwar.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I totally forgot about that. Yeah. So that's a beef?
It was a fake beef.
Okay.
A fun beef.
All right.
But apparently they've buried the hatchet.
What was the name of the movie Ethan Embry, it went straight to VOD, and it shouldn't have. It should have gotten a theatrical release, or maybe it did get like a theatrical release, but briefly. A horror movie he made where he was, had a wife and kid and a guitar. It was like a cursed, like sort of devil, evil guitar.
The Devil's Candy.
Oh, great movie.
Yeah, no, that is a great movie. Great movie.
He's terrific in that movie. Unrecognizable. Like, if you look at Ethan Embry from the early days, from the Can't Hardly Wait days.
Yeah, no.
Which is a movie I like. I like Can't Hardly Wait.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
And now he looks ridiculously different. He's also, by the way, in the Don Coscarelli Masters of Horror.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, he's in
which one is that?
The incident on a... Incident on a mountain
off a mountain road.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah,
he's in that, and that was like the first time like he looked.
Nice.
That was like the first time I was like, boy, he looks buffed.
Yeah, he looks way more adult because you see him in Empire Records.
Yeah, he looks like a teen.
Yeah,
he looks like the same that he looked in Can't Hardly Wait.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, and then finally, the Griswold's car may have helped kill the station wagon market. The Griswolds' chariot in their first adventure, the Queen Wagon Family Truckster, was modified. A modified 1979 Ford LTD Country Squire. It's clear in Vacation that this car is for squares, as it's not the first choice of Clark, a notorious square, and the design elements all amplify elements in commercial station wagons. From the faux wood paneling to the boxy, inelegant design... Maybe it's no coincidence, then, that station wagon sales declined over the ensuing decades, all but vanishing from modern roads. That's what automotive writer Pete Bigelow speculates, pointing to the fact that Vacation hit theaters in 1983, the very same year Chrysler rolled out the first minivan for American drivers, hastening the wagon's demise. Of course, many other factors were at play, but Clark's unease with his new ride certainly fit with consumers' changing tastes in the 80s. The end of the station wagon.
R.I.P.
Yeah. I remember my aunt had a station wagon, and we would just sit in the seats that would fold up and face backwards and forwards. No, we never had. I mean, the 70s, there was no, you never put seatbelts on, kids.
Ralph Nader hadn't got to him yet.
I used to bounce around in the backseat of the car like a ping pong ball. But yeah, dude, my aunt had a wagon, and they had the stupid fold up seats that, you know, that you could look at each other. Like one person is facing the back window, one person is facing the front window, the windshield. Station wagons.
When my mom described to me like what a station wagon was, because I was too young to really know what a classic station wagon was, when she described that to me, I was like, "This sounds like a death trap. Like, are you trying to kill people in a car? Is this the goal of being in a car?"
I remember one time, all my dad did, seatbelts. We never put seatbelts on in the 70s. You just throw the kid in the back seat and shut up. And I remember my dad just made a left, and I smacked my head on the window. The side of my head on the passenger side window.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. It was that simple. But nobody cared back in the 70s. You kidding me? Seat belts.
This is what's wrong with this country today.
I'm telling you, man. Belts. Man, it was, you know, I'm not saying that obviously everybody should wear their seatbelts, they're lifesavers, and you have to have them. You have to wear them. But back in the 70s, nobody gave a damn about that stuff. Nobody cared.
Back in the day, you had to bootleg cores.
Yeah. I don't have time for seatbelts. I got to get to the Stuckies. I don't have time for a seatbelt right now. And it was really funny because, like, it was widespread. I mean, you know, people smoking in cars with no seatbelts. That's what it was in the 70s.
Opening up beer bottles with their...
And this was also before...
That's what you use the seatbelt for, was to open up the bottle.
This is also before they lowered the speed limit to 55.
Right.
So you could go 75 miles an hour, smoke a bunch of cigarettes, and bop around in the back with no seatbelt.
Listen to Rush.
Those were the days. Yeah. All right. The news is up right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiCilio here on 720 WGN. Welcome back. We're going to be talking about albums that shaped punk rock. That was not punk rock. That was a little speed metal for you on Two for Tuesday. You mean Two for Tuesday? Who requested that?
That was Zach wanting to hear a little Metallica.
Metallica, yeah. Now, Vic, you were telling us that you are listening now to, or you listened to the Ramones as part of the Vic's Picks.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And yes, it didn't do much for you.
Well, yeah, I was saying that I think, well, it's just punk, that genre. I'm missing something. There's something missing. I'm not falling in love with punk, and I don't know, maybe it's, I need to dig deeper into the origins of punk or what, but when I listen to the Ramones or Sex Pistols, I listened to them recently, like last month, I just don't feel it, you know?
Yeah.
Well, but I want to like Ramones and Sex Pistols.
We've got some albums that shaped punk rock here that we're going to go through. And here's what they say. This is from a great website, Vic, a really terrific music website that you might want to bookmark.
Okay.
If you want to read articles about, you know, like really well written,
oh, yeah,
and well researched articles about music. It's called Consequence of Sound.
Got it.
Consequenceofsound.net. They have a staff of incredibly educated writers, and they write about a lot. I mean, they write about, you know, a lot of entertainment. But they do concentrate a lot on music, and this is a website that, you know, if you want to read intelligent, well written, thoughtful articles about music or artists or anything like that, consequenceofsound.net is way up there on my recommendations.
Yeah, it's a nice website. Thanks.
Yep. So where does it say? Where does the story of punk rock begin? You might land inside a cramped Midwestern garage with the Kingsmen's Louie Louie crackling through the radio. in a gutted London loft reverberating with the clash of drum and guitar or any number of other places that can rightfully claim to be punk rock's Eden. The fact of the matter is that punk is a pretty shapeless thing. It has a beginning, a middle, and maybe an end, but things get murkier from there. The genre's most celebrated practitioners can't even seem to agree on the outlines of a common ideology. To Joe Strummer of The Clash, punk rock eventually came to be known as showing exemplary manners to your fellow human beings. Fugazi's Ian McKay could probably go along with that, but good luck with the provocateurs of Crass on board. And then there are those who would define punk rock as its musical freedom, and but do three chord songs completed in 2 minutes really sound any freer than, say, an expansive soundscape of prog rock? It is complicated. With that said, punk rock does have a story, and that's what we're here to tell at Consequence of Sound. Our version may be incomplete, and there may be other equally valid versions out there, but we think we've done right by punk by letting the music speak the loudest. And what follows is our story of punk in 50 albums, each serving a different chapter in the evolution of the genre and subculture. Take note that we aren't calling these the greatest punk albums of all time, though many of them qualify. We're simply saying that without these 50 albums, punk wouldn't be where it is today, confused, chaotic, and contentious as ever. So that's the intro. Colin Brennan wrote that. He's a senior writer with Consequence of Sound. And it does seem pretty accurate, because it is a tough genre to nail down. A lot of different kinds of bands fit under the big umbrella of punk. Mm-hmm. And the influences of some of these albums that we're going to talk about influence bands that don't belong in the category of punk at all. And there are a few albums on this list that I don't consider punk albums. For instance, the first one, these are in chronological order, the way they put these. So, like, the history of punk kind of chronologically, where they kind of think it begins.
Okay.
First one is 1969, The Kinks, the first album by The Kinks. Have you listened to any Kinks?
No.
Wait a minute. There's no Kinks album in the top 100?
Don't think so. I don't think.
God, wait a minute.
At least not yet.
Mm. Oh, that's. Oh,
I'm
man.
Looking up. All right, calm down. Let me look it up and make sure. All right.
Oh, there's got to be at least one Kinks album in the top 100, the Rolling Stones top 100. That's. Wow. That's a massive oversight if there's no Kinks in the top 100.
Not even the. The Kinks are the Village Green Preservation Society. Man. I love that.
Here we go.
I mean, oh. Jeez.
Oh, hold on. No, that's not it. No, I'm looking, but let's move on. I will continue the search.
Well, The Kinks, 1964. When The Kinks released their self-titled debut album in 64, plenty of critics dismissed them as just another cheap coin in the Mercy Beat jukebox. When they failed to see that the tracks were so rollicking. And then, of course, you know, you really got me. And this is, and it's influenced everybody from Van Halen, obviously, to the Stooges. The Kinks, you know, although not really considered a punk band, British Invasion. But they really did kind of lay a little groundwork, especially in that time period.
Yeah.
And especially in 1964.
It's kind of like how the song Helter Skelter by the Beatles could be considered the first, like, metal song.
Yeah, that's what they
really want to.
If you want to go back to that, yeah.
Yeah.
Next is the Velvet Underground and Nico, 1967. This definitely falls under a noise album. And I know you're going to hear that one, right, Vic?
What is it?
The Velvet Underground and Nico.
That doesn't draw. You
with
know,
the banana?
That's got to be in the top 100.
What's it called again?
The Velvet Underground is the band.
That does sound
The familiar. Album is called The Velvet Underground and Nico, and the front cover is iconic. It's an Andy Warhol painting of a banana.
Yeah, that's on there.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and I haven't got to it yet.
Yeah, and what number are you on right now?
33, 34, 35, somewhere around there.
So Velvet Underground and Nico is in the top 30.
Yep.
Okay,
that's
makes
about
sense.
Right, yeah.
That makes sense. It still doesn't make up for the Kinks not being the top 100. All right, we go to the next one, 1969. This is a big one. MC5, Kick Out the Jams. This is a groundbreaking album, man. And by the way, they're not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, right?
I'll check. I'm pretty sure no.
I mean, come on, man. What are we talking about here? So MC5, Kick Out the Jams. I think that's another one you're going to be listening to, Vic.
Okay, and I have found out that the Kinks, they do have an album on Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Albums of All Time, but I found that on somebody's blog, and they were kind enough to list all of the bands, all 500 of them, without numbering them sequentially.
Yeah. Oh, there you go.
So you'd have to count all the way down. It seems like it's pretty far down the list, but it's definitely not top 100.
That's ridiculous.
And as for the MC5, they have been included on the ballot in 2003, 2017, and 2018, but they've never been inducted. They've never made it.
All right. This is a big one. 1973, Raw Power, Iggy and the Stooges.
Incredible.
A great record and a landmark record for the punk genre. And again, there's even more subgenres within the punk genre itself. Because Iggy and the Stooges, they don't sound like the Sex Pistols.
No,
I mean, but it's clearly there's an attitude to it that really is pretty consistent, and that was 1973. 1973 again, a big one, New York Dolls. With David Johansen, who would go on to be what the hell was it, Buster Poindexter, two completely different kind of music styles, but yeah, and New York Dolls it has punk elements to it, but that's a glam that kind of initiated like the whole subgenre of glam rock.
Yeah, especially with the get-ups,
and so did Iggy Pop too.
Right.
Yeah. Now, you listen to this one. Here's one, Vic, that you've listened to.
Yeah.
And it's on this list as, you know, one of the 50 albums that shaped punk rock, and that's Horses by Patti Smith.
Oh, yeah.
From 1975.
She's going to be at Riot Fest this year.
Yeah. No, she's still out there, man.
Yeah.
She's still out there. And what did you think of this? You thought it was strange, but
Horses?
Yeah.
That album was now that I recall, it's one of the more memorable albums I've listened to, which I mean, out of a group of 70 albums, that says a lot, but
yeah.
Yeah, because of the diversity in the album. I mean, I think there was the first song was much different than I expected, and then the second one started kind of with poetry.
Yeah.
And then the third, yeah, it was kind of all over the place for me a little bit, but then, you know, like as I read about Patti a little more, kind of understood, you know,
it says,
her music a little bit. You have to understand where she's coming from to kind of get that music.
Patti Smith knows how to be an outsider, they say, scraping by in New York City in the 70s as a painter, writer, performer. She balanced life in the margins with an understanding the need for connection. So she was inspired by French poetry, Doors vocalist Jim Morrison, and then when she made this record, and then most recently deceased Jimi Hendrix. So those are all people that you've listened to,
yeah,
who they say influenced Patti Smith.
She's in that new Bob Dylan documentary.
Really?
Because she was hanging out with Dylan on that Rolling Thunder review, and they got a performance by her that was very strange.
Yeah. It's certainly challenging. So, all right, we got to take a quick break here. And Consequence of Sound is the website, and we're talking about punk rock because we had one of the leaders of the LA punk rock movement on earlier, and it was a real pleasure to have John Doe on from the band X, who, by the way, are playing tomorrow night at the City Winery.
Still get tickets.
Yeah, you can still get tickets.
Left.
CityWinery.com. Good morning. Jeez. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 has your morning drive. It's 2 for Tuesday. 312-981-7200. We had John Doe on from the band X earlier this morning, and it was great. And if you missed the interview, you should definitely check out the podcast when it's put up on the website. For sure, because it was great. They're playing, X is playing tomorrow night at the City Winery. And so that's going to be a great show. But that got us thinking about punk rock. And so Consequence of Sound put together an article where they picked the albums that shaped punk rock. They put them together and wrote pieces about them, put them in chronological order. And that's what we're talking about now. A couple of texts have come in. 708 area code says, Wild in the Street should be in the top 10. Keith Morris is a genius. And then 309 area code says, Early Who. I would agree with that. Who's not on this list, though? They're not on here.
Yeah, I think that's a weird omission.
It is.
Especially some stuff from Quadrophenia and even like My Generation.
I would go, I mean, I would be, I think might be odd to pick a live album, but I would pick Live at Leeds.
Yeah.
That would be the one that I would go with immediately.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. That's a crazy album.
It is. It is. All right, so Vic, we are now at the Ramones here. Here's what they say about the Ramones, and this is the piece that they wrote. Colin Brennan again from Consequence of Sound wrote this
good
piece.
All right, cool.
This is the 1976 self-titled Ramones album, which Vic listened to a little bit earlier this week.
Yep, just like within the last 48 hours.
Here's what they say about it: when the Ramones' landmark 1976 self-titled album turned 40 last year, our own Ryan Bray noted just how ubiquitous the album's No BS sound had become, comparing it to a genetic imprint that, quote, defined punk the same way that the Beatles did with pop or Black Sabbath did with metal. But the Ramones' first album did more than just pave the way for the rash of young, dumb, gleefully defiant bands that would follow in their path. Songs like the mighty Blitzkrieg Bop and the Screeching Chainsaw rewrote the rules of rock and roll, stripping every trace of pretense from the genre until all that was left was a boundless sense of energy and an aimless sense of purpose. In the decades following, bands ranging from Misfits to Green Day would take Ramones' three-chord gospel to heart. So that's how they sum.
That's pretty much what I got out of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I didn't. That's helpful, man. Articles like that for, like you said, albums who are a little less accessible than others, albums, they're really helpful, those articles.
Yeah. And, you know, you could hear it in, I mean, you could especially hear it in Green Day, like big time in Green Day. But yeah. And then Green Day would go on, you know, they started out kind of like Ramone-esque, but then they became more ambitious as they got older. I mean, an album like American Idiot, would not be considered Ramone-esque, although there are riffs on it that could be.
I think I'm going to go home and... Oh, go ahead. You're going to say something.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I only listened to this album once, the self-titled Ramones album, and I've been listening to them twice now. I give it a one through,
and
then I'll go back and listen intently and read about the band. So I'm going to do that probably today.
You know, the thing about the Ramones album, it won't take you long to get through it.
Yeah, no.
That's the other thing about the Ramones record.
20 minutes.
Every song is like 2.5 minutes long.
Yeah,
so
it's very tight and...
Yeah.
Work through it in about 45 minutes.
From 1977, Suicide by Suicide would go on to inspire a lot of... also from 1977, big year for the quote-unquote punk genre, because The Damned came out with their album in 1977. And this is a band that definitely is very influential and really an important band. There's no question about it. And then following on the heels of that, in 1977, of course, Sex Pistols, Never Mind the Bollocks. It's no exaggeration to say the Sex Pistols reinvented punk rock with Never Mind the Bollocks, stripping the genre of its nostalgia, 50s rock and roll, and replacing it with razor-edged nihilism, and that has no home but here and now. Johnny Rotten said it all. The first two words of Anarchy in the UK is right now. Whereas the Ramones made punk rock manic and playful, the Sex Pistols made it into something downright dangerous, a weaponized force of nature aimed directly at the Queen's precious head. Speaking of the Queen, Nevermind the Bollocks was the first punk album to truly politicize punk, forging an inexorable connection between the grimy power chords and the goings-on of modern governments. As such, it's perhaps the most important album in the history of punk rock. It made an impact on the genre that's impossible to overstate.
Launched 1,000 bands.
Yeah. man, I'm telling you, 1977. You ready for the next one, too, here? These are all in the same year. 1977, The Clash's first album came out.
Oh, jeez. Wow.
What a year, man.
The only band that matters. The Clash.
I love that band so much. Yeah, and that's a massively important. Have you heard any Clash? Were are there any?
Yep, there was one on the list, but it was back in the early days of when I started doing this.
So it was down low
and
on
I,
the list.
It was down low, and I also was not. I was just listening to them. I wasn't reading about anything about the band or taking. So I can't even recall it. I think I'm gonna have to go back over those like
was it London Calling?
It was probably London Calling.
I have to look it up.
Would be my guess.
Yeah.
That would be my guess, London Calling.
It's too bad he's not listening to Sandinista.
Sandinista is a hell of a record. Man.
I'm going to listen to all of the Clash's of stuff record. Eventually.
A triple album from a punk band, and they're doing reggae, they're doing dub.
The Clash is a combat rock. I know that was their most commercial record, but they were an important band. I mean, the Clash, they were a really, really important band. That, you know, my friends, especially friends who are around my age, maybe a little bit younger, formed like their rebellion. Like that was the band that they went to.
Oh, yeah.
Like when London Calling came out, man, my friends went nuts, you know.
I remember being in middle school. That's how you knew that someone was like cool, was if they had like a Ramones t-shirt, especially a Clash t-shirt. If they were wearing the Clash to school, you're like, oh, man, I got to be friends with this dude.
Okay, you ready for this one? Again, 1977. All of these, 1977. Television, Marquee Moon.
Unbelievable.
I mean, you can't. I mean, how did all this? How did all this stuff come out?
All around, like around so many different places too.
Yeah. Television is that again. This is an extraordinary album. I think one of the best albums of all time. Now, have you? Do you know if that's on there? Television is the name of the band.
I don't recall seeing that. No, it might be
in the top 30. I mean, it might be up pretty high because it's a pretty legendary
London
record.
Calling is number 8 on their.
Oh, so you've got that to look forward to. Okay,
yeah, that's the highest appearance of any punk
band. Oh, okay, all right, good.
But I'm gonna have to double check that.
I would get. My guess is that Television has to be on that list.
Let me see. Oh, here we go.
Television. Marquee Moon is the name of the record. My guess is they've got to be on the list. So, and then while we were checking on that, the last one that was released in 77, a banner year, Wire with Pink Flag.
Wow.
I mean, that's just ridiculous. That is ridiculous.
Yeah. Okay. So London Calling by The Clash is definitely number 8 on the top 500 greatest albums of all time.
Wow.
Wow.
All right. There you go. We're talking about some punk here. If you guys want to jump in with Talk or Text, it's 312-981-7200. Consequence of Sound put together a really extensive article going chronologically and talking about the albums that shaped punk. We had John Doe earlier from the band X. It was such a great interview. And Vic is diving deep into the music world and is going to be encountering more punk and has encountered some punk as he listens to the top 100 records of the Rolling Stone. So if you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. And the news is up after this. Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich at 5 with the opening bell. Steve Cochran at 6 right here on WGN. And, welcome back. We've been talking about punk rock and the evolution of punk and the albums that shaped punk rock a little bit earlier this morning. We had, as a guest, John Doe on from the band X, and it was a fantastic interview. And X is playing tomorrow at the City Winery tomorrow night. And so he was on to talk about that, and he was on to talk about the film, the many, many film roles that he's had, and his new book, which is about the punk rock movement in the 80s in L.A., of which he was a massive member. So that was fun, and we thought we'd continue talking a little bit about punk right now and some of the albums that actually shaped punk. 312 area code says Susie and the Banshees. Susie and the Banshees is actually included here in this article, and deservedly so. Absolutely. And then 815 area code says the Seeds could be considered early punk. Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. I can absolutely see that. Jay from Wisconsin said Beauty and the Beat, the Go-Go's first album in 1983, was about chicks like Charlotte Caffey writing their own music, chick punk fashion, including short skirts, and chicks playing guitar, doing drugs and alcohol, and drums, and as popular as the new Calvin Klein jeans and the preppy chick fashions of penny loafers and plaid, and girl attitude aiming for the president of corporate America by the age of 25 and not being married. The Go-Go's are extensively included in John Doe's book for their first record. So next here, we're moving to 1978. Buzzcocks, another Music in a Different Kitchen. I can't even kind of explain how depressed I was when we lost Pete Shelley a few months back. He died in December. That was a big one. That was a big loss. Buzzcocks, great band. He was amazing. So, also from 78, Devo, Are We Not Men? We Are Devo. Come on, man.
It's crazy how big of a career Mark Mothersbaugh has had.
Yeah. And now
just doing film scores.
Doing film scores. He, like Danny Elfman, you know, was in a popular sort of new wave punky band. And this one, I don't consider this album, I don't consider Devo a punk album. The attitude is there, but I don't consider it a punk album.
Well, I mean, if you listen to like Uncontrollable Urge,
yeah,
that's got it. But they're more new wave, which is a weird.
And their version of Satisfaction is fantastic.
Yeah.
And I saw Devo live. I've only seen them once, and they were unbelievable. They were great. It was such a great show. Next, from 78, is another album that I don't consider punk, but I can see why it's part of what shaped punk. It's Blondie, Parallel Lines.
Well, because they were there, you know. Yeah. They were playing CBGB.
Oh, yeah, they were. They were.
They went more pop, I guess.
Susie and the Banshee, also from 1978, yeah. The Scream. Moving on to 79, Joy Division.
My favorite.
Unknown Pleasures. That definitely fits into the category, and especially how influential it was and how it changed. Let's see. Here's Beth on WGN. Hi, Beth.
Hi, Nick.
Hi.
First of all, I want to ask you, what's your first record and what's your first concert?
Oh, I've answered this one before. It was.
I know, but I haven't been here in a while, and I want you to ask me, really.
Well, all right. My first album was Black Sabbath, Paranoid. My first concert was Black Oak, Arkansas, and Bad Company.
Okay, my first concert was Black Sabbath. When Ozzy was on his way out with Chesty Hill S60.
All right, so it's like right before Never Say Die, because Never Say Die was their last.
I don't know. Some guy offered me a hamburger and something on paper.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right, what was your first album? And no. Then we got to move on.
No, you're not moving on.
Well, yeah, I am, because it's my show, Beth. So that's how it works. No, you're not moving on. Yeah, I'm on this show called the Nick DiGilio Show, so yeah, I'll move on. It's not the Beth Show. Thank you for calling, though, Beth. Is it a full moon?
Not quite. No, we've passed that. I think it was a little while ago, the full moon.
It's always weird. You know, Dan over the years used to tell me, Dan Shigeru, my former producer, used to tell me that it got really weird a few days before the full moon. That's when it got really, really weird.
Oh, I trust me. He's not lying. Dan was...
Oh, no. I've been doing the late night shift for many years on this radio station, and it gets real weird.
Yeah, man.
So, well, my ex-wife, Heather, she's a punk rock girl, big time punk rock girl.
Mm-hmm. I think the Milkman had a song about that.
She was, still is, and this is one of her favorite bands that's next on this list, one of her favorite bands of all time, Stiff Little Fingers. She went nuts over this band, and she went to, you know, she's been to a whole punk rock. She used to hang out at the Fireside.
In the
heyday of the Fireside, she was there all the time.
I've only seen it recently,
and she's definitely at in her heart, she's all about punk rock. And she turned me on to a band that doesn't necessarily fall into the kind of punk. They're out of Canada. I bet Canadian Bill knows them. Do you know a band called No Means No?
No means no. No.
Oh, man.
Out of Canada.
Out of Canada. Older dudes now. They're like in their late 50s now. They're an incredible band. They're an incredible band. My ex turned me on to them. We saw them twice. We went to go see No Means No twice. I've never, and they were unbelievable. And they're older dudes now. You know, they've got a side band called the Hanson Brothers, which are inspired by Slapshot.
The Paul Newman?
Yeah, inspired by the characters in Slapshot.
I like that. I like that a lot.
We actually, at our wedding reception, because this is, it's hardcore stuff. It's pretty heavy. And I think they're a phenomenal band. At our reception, we played a song called Rags and Bones, which is by No Means No, and completely cleared the dance floor. Heather and I were out there rocking with a couple of our friends, you know, who were also, you know, knew of No Means No. Everybody, like all the relatives, are like, what the hell is happening right now?
Love it.
But yeah, so No Means No was this bitch. She totally turned me on to this band. I became obsessed with them too. I just think they're great. They're just great. And Rags and Bones is my favorite. They have a lot of amazing songs, but Rags and Bones is just, that's a song that, like, it's when you hear it, you just go nuts. It's got an unbelievable riff. Like a really, you can find it. Find Rags and Bones by No Means No. And No Means No is one word. No Means No. It's not three words. One word. There's no space in between. No Means No. But yeah, it's this Rags and Bones, and it's a jam. A major, major jam. Dead Kennedys came out in 1980. That's also mentioned here, as it should be, obviously. Do you have it?
Yeah, I do. All right. I want to hear it all. Here we go.
Yeah, and it gets bigger too. Just let it play for a little bit. Yeah. So this is the riff. Then here we go. No, sir. Here we go. So there you go. That's Rags and Bones.
That's wild.
Yeah.
That's like, that's some, would it be wrong to compare that to like kind of Fugazi?
No, it was, yeah, I guess very, it falls into that category.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, that's ridiculous.
That's No Means No. That's No Means No. And that was the song that Heather played for me. The first, because I've never heard of this band before. She played Rags and Bones. She's like, here's a song that I think you'll enjoy. She played Rags and Bones. I almost busted every piece of furniture in her apartment.
See, I was up here dancing in the newsroom, too. See, I like that. What was that again?
It's a Canadian band called No Means No, and that's a song called Rags and Bones. And it was that was a song that, you know, my ex-wife Heather and I played at our reception and cleared the dance floor. That's not like a song that you hear like at a, you know, like our friends and stuff, we were kind of rocking and Heather and I were going nuts, but like, you know, family members and relatives were like, what the hell is we listening to?
Is that a song?
That was a song.
Oh
yeah. That was a song that was called, Rags and Bones by a Canadian punk band called No Means No.
I think I wanted to split my head open.
Yeah. It's a jam. That's what you want to do. You want to smash your head against something when you hear that.
Yeah. Is Peter Paul a Mary punk?
Bring it on. That was awful.
No, all right. All right. Okay.
Sorry.
Enjoy Slippery When Wet.
I am old. You guys, I'm listening the whole way in. I'm like, what language are they speaking? I don't even know who these, I know some of the bands, but I.
Well, punk's clearly not your thing.
No.
Yeah.
And I mean, I grew up with the Ramones and all that, you know, but I just, you know.
You don't like the Ramones?
Oh, I do. I do.
Yeah, you got to love the Ramones.
Yeah, yeah, everybody
does. All right, talk to Vic about that. Will you do me a favor, Mary?
Oh, he doesn't like them?
I'm going to listen to them until I do, Mary.
Oh, okay.
I will like the Ramones.
Okay, cool. Welcome back, everybody. Did we get who requested the Stevie Ray Vaughan?
No, that was Sam.
Oh, Sam. Okay, because we forgot to acknowledge it was Sam that requested the Stevie Ray Vaughan on Two for Tuesday. Yeah, Two for Tuesday. We'll be back with that next week. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell, and also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, wrapping up the conversation about what albums formed punk. Here are some of the other ones. We'll fly through these. In 1981, Black Flag, Damaged. 1982, Misfits, Walk Among Us, Glenn Danzig. You know, his movie got an actual release.
Are you serious?
It's coming out in October. It's coming out in October. It got picked up.
I just heard it's a total trash fire.
Yeah, it is. But someone picked it up. I can't tell you. I think it was just a small independent studio. But it's getting a theatrical release in October.
A profitable trash fire.
82, The Descendants with Milo Goes to College. 1982, Faith Void with Faith Void Split. Suicidal Tendencies in 1983. Got to put them in there. Also in 1983, Minor Threat, Out of Step. Also one of my ex-wife's favorite bands, Minor Threat. 83, Social Distortion, their first album. And then now we're moving on to one of my favorite bands that has ever existed in the world of existing. 1984, Zen Arcade by Husker Du, which is one of my favorite bands. And Bob Mould, I can't even explain how much I love Bob Mould.
What was the name of the band he did after? Was it Sugar?
Sugar.
Sugar's awesome.
And then he released a few solo records.
Yeah. Really talented guy.
Sugar's great, man. 1985, this is another one of my favorite bands of all time. The Pogues with Rum, Sodomy, and the Lash. Those guys, man. I'll tell you. I saw them. I've seen the Pogues. I saw the Pogues four times. I saw them four times. And again, as we were saying, you know, as we've said before, like when you go and see The Replacements, which is another band that was inspired by all this music. The Replacements, a very important band in my life. When you see The Replacements, you don't know which Replacements you're going to get, or at least back in the day, because I think Paul's clean now, or at least he's moderately drinking, not to the extent that he was in the 80s and early 90s. But when you go and see The Replacements, you didn't know what Replacements you were going to get. So when you go and see the Pogues, you don't know what Shane McGowan you're going to get. I was at the Guinness Fest outdoor festival. It was like, I don't know, maybe this was 20 years ago, maybe 15, 20 years ago. I was at the Guinness Fest. It was 95 degrees outside. It was horrible. And all they had to drink was Guinness. Oh, no. Now, listen, I loved Guinness. To the core of my being, I loved Guinness, but not on a 95 degree day. That's like the last drink that you want to have.
Guinness was a bad choice.
A horrible choice, but one of the greatest drinks that's ever that ever passed my lips. Mm-hmm. Haven't had one in such a long time. It's been such a long time, and I can't have one because I'll end up having 50. That's just the nature of my personality. So anyway, I go to the can, all right? I'm going to the bathroom, which was also real pleasant at 95-degree weather. You're an outdoor concert, so you're going to porta-potties. That was a really, really pleasant. I come out, and the trailer, the Pogues trailer, was located not very far from the porta-potty. So I get out of the porta-potty, and I'm walking back to my friends, and I look over, and the door opens up, and there's Shane McGowan. He took one step out of the trailer, faced down. Boom, just face down. And I was like, and this was like, you know, there was still another band to play before the Pogues came on. So I went back to my friends and I'm like, yeah, I don't think this is going to be a good show, because he just took a header. He walked out of the trailer and just like completely face planted onto the ground. And so it was always that way. I mean, it wasn't just booze with him too, because he did a lot of drugs and everything. And
his teeth?
Well, he got new teeth, which disappoints me, because one of my favorite things about Shane McGowan is his teeth. When he got the new teeth, I'm like, no! But anyway, and so every time we went back and saw him at the Congress. They played two nights at the Congress, and this was like in the mid-2000s. And again, you know, you're like, okay, don't know what kind of Shane McGowan we're going to get. And oh my God, were they good. And he looked great. But yeah, the Pogues are one of my favorite bands of all time, and they recorded my favorite Christmas song of all time. Fairy Tale in New York is my favorite Christmas song of all time. Beastie Boys, License to Ill.
That's
a game changer.
Yeah.
My favorite Beastie Boys record, and I know that, that most people say it's Paul's Boutique, and Paul's Boutique is a masterpiece, but Check Your Head is my favorite.
Check Your Head's amazing.
Love that. I love that record. 1986, Bad Brains, Eye Against
Eye.
Oh,
God, yeah.
Yeah. 1987, Big Black. Good old Steve Albini.
That guy, I saw him in G-Man's not that long ago.
Yeah.
I went to a Cubs game, went into G-Man's, and there he was just standing there. And he looked at me, and I looked back at him, and he kind of gave me the eyes like, don't do it, man.
Yeah,
just leave me. And I was like, okay.
Yeah, leave me alone.
You produced the greatest Nirvana record.
Yes, he did. Operation Ivy from 1989 with their album Energy. 1990, we mentioned him earlier, Fugazi with Repeater. 1994, Green Day, Dookie. You got to include it.
Mm-hmm.
What else do we got here? Oh, Sleater-Kinney with Dig Me Out from 1997. That's cool.
They got a new record coming soon.
Do they?
Yeah, they're doing it with St. Vincent.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting marriage.
Against Me with Reinventing Axl Rose from 2002. Exploding Hearts, Guitar Romantic from 2003. Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs, Fever to Tell from 2003. And I think there's one more left, and I can't say the name of the band. It's Effed Up with the Chemistry of Common Life from 2008.
Great modern punk band.
Yeah.
Amazing modern punk band.
Well, there you go. That's Consequence of Sound if you want to check that out. I'm talking about the albums that shaped punk. And again, we'll get another edition of Vic's Picks coming up on Friday. Hey, listen, tomorrow on the show, we've got Rod Pyle, our space guy. Lots of space stuff to talk about with Rod. Always a blast when he's on. Rod Pyle's going to join us. We'll have another round of Know Your Onion, so know the difference between a real news headline and an onion news headline. And then another round of Wild Card Wednesday, where you can request anything, or any artist, anything, anything. So that's all coming up on the show for your Wednesday morning right here on 720 WGN.